Yes, so tonight we're beginning a new perek. Again, we're coming towards the end of the sefer, more or less. Then we'll just chazir it again, or as I say, okay, so funny. I mentioned one possibility would be the Evan Shlema. The Evan Shlema, it's a sefer perhaps you've looked at, you've seen, is a likutz of the teachings of the Gra on Musar and Midos, taken from all of the Gra's Svarim, but probably 80% is taken from Mishlei. So for example, so it's organized topically. So if the Gra talks about Tshuva, let's say 20 different times in Mishlei, it'll give you the 20 teachings. So in a way, it's a way of chazering, but it's also a way of systematically seeing the whole picture. So that might be a possibility. I don't know, but you can look. If you can look at the Evan Shlema, you can get a sense of what it is. Okay, so we're Perek Chaf Gimel. And here, the Gra takes a bit of an unusual approach. As you know, by far the largest part of the Sefer is from Perek Yud through Perek Chaf Dalet, up until the beginning of Chaf Hei. And those are, by and large, short psukim, in which there's not that much connection between one pasuk and the other. In other words, unlike Perek Aleph to Tes, where the psukim would often be a whole unit, a large unit, these are episodic. These are very short aphorisms. But here, unlike most of the Sefer, the Gra reads the first eight psukim. Mamish, the first eight psukim as one thematic unit. Right? That's why you'll notice if you have a Bir HaGra, the comment is called Aleph to Ches. And let's just look at the psukim, and then we'll go back and see how the Gra understands them. Ki seishev lil chom es moshel. When you sit, lil chom, we'll come back to that, es moshel, with a ruler. Now, lil chom is a bit of a strange verb. Lil chom can mean when you wage war, lashon milchama. Or lil chom can mean when you eat bread, when you break bread. In fact, already the Rishayim point out that there is an etymological connection between milchama and lechem, because wars were often fought to gain land to be able to increase a food supply. So here, one question we'll have to see is lil chom referring to fighting with the king? Or is it referring to a ruler, or does it refer to eating with the king? Now, contextually, though, you'll see as you go weiter that this is almost certainly referring to eating with the king. And the Gra says that, and I mean, that's really the hemshech of the psukim as well. But you can understand why, you'll see, why does it use a double entendre, which can also mean fighting, because you'll see that essentially, lefi pshuto, it's basically saying, when you're invited to a royal banquet, you got to be very, very careful. You might get the king angry and all sorts of things will happen. Now again, this is not referring so much to a White House dinner. First of all, the word Moshel is very important. The Gra, not here. But there's a very, very famous horror of the Gra that is often said around Rosh Hashanah time. What is the difference between a Melech and a Moshel? A Melech is someone that is freely chosen by his people. Maybe it's hereditary monarchy, but the people acclaim him, the people want him. So Queen Elizabeth, right, although it might be true that nobody appointed her, but people are mamlich, people accept her, as, by and large, they accept her as the sovereign. A moshel is a dictator who imposes his will upon you, and you did not accept it. That's how the Gra learns the pasuk, ki lashem hamlucha u'moshel bagoyim. Vis-a-vis the Goyim, Hashem is a Moshel. They didn't accept him. Legabe Am Yisrael, he's a Melech. That's why we say the Avodah of Rosh Hashanah is to make Hashem a Melech. What do you mean, make Hashem a Melech? I mean, Hashem is already a Melech. Not quite. Hashem, by definition, is a Moshel because he created the world and he can do whatever he wants. But he doesn't become a Melech until we, by our Bechira, freely accept Hashem as a Melech. And this is a very, very well-known Ha'ara of the Gra, although he doesn't say it here. But I would think that we should read it into here, because you'll see that the dangers that are being described when you're invited to the king would more apply to a Moshel, not so much to a Melech. So it says, when you sit to eat bread with the king, again, we'll see the Gra's deeper meaning shortly, but I just want to look at the Pashat Pshat first. When you are invited to sit with the king, bin tovin eis asher lefanecha, understand what you're facing. What does that mean? V'samta sakin bilo echa, you shall place, this is sakin, an unusual sin instead of samach, but sakin means a knife. Put a knife in your throat, meaning don't eat too much. That's the first thing. Watch your manners, don't eat too much, because the king might be watching you. What did they say? They say that there was this Chinese banquet. This is an actual, and this goes back to the 1,000 years ago, where there were like 50 courses, but the emperor ate very, very quickly. So as soon as the emperor finished, they always brought the other course. And no one was able to eat because he finished. So no one got anything. But here is the opposite. Basically, the concept is that just because the king has you over, it doesn't mean you're his buddy. And if you behave with over-familiarity, many things can happen to you. So it says, Besamta sakin b'lo'echa, put a knife in your throat, im bal nefesh at. Now here, it's very, very fascinating that the word bal nefesh might mean the opposite of what it's become to mean in halacha. You'll recall that the Mishnah Berurah, but again, he's not the first one, often uses the phrase when the question is what the halacha is, so the hachra of the Mishnah Berurah might mean that meikir haden, something is permitted, but a bal nefesh should be machmir. A bal nefesh should be machmir. So a bal nefesh doesn't have an exact definition, but it means somebody who is greater, has a lot of Yiras Shemayim, somebody who is very strong in their Yiddishkeit. One should try to be machmer, even if it's not a chiyuv. So bal nefesh, whatever it, and people always ask, am I a bal nefesh? Not me, but you know, people will ask me, are they a bal nefesh? How do I know? You know. but it may be one of those things. If you have to ask, you know, you're not. And I don't know. In other words, just like a kanoi, right? The halacha is if a non-Jew, if a Jew is having intercourse with a non-Jewish woman in a public place. So if you are a kanoi, you are allowed to kill them, like Pinchas did at the time of the maisa. You can't kill them afterwards, but b'shas maisa, you can kill them. But if you ask a shaila, should I kill them? We say no, but the mafarshim say, because if you asked, you weren't acting out of the heat of the moment. So, but whatever it is, bal nefesh as used in the poskim refers to somebody who is more attuned to their spiritual needs than their physical. But here, in this pasuk of Mishlei, it actually means the opposite. Nefesh refers to the animal soul, the animal passion. And a bal nefesh is somebody who's equivalent to a bal taiva. And therefore, the pasuk is actually saying, if you have a propensity to indulge in your taiva, put a knife in your throat and don't do a lot in front of the king because you're going to make a bad impression. And historically, this was not, this was not things to laugh at. When people misbehaved, let's say in Stalin's house or whatever it is, they might get killed. You know, they might get killed. All sorts of things would happen. Okay. And then it says, Al Tisav. I'll go back to show you how the Gra learns this. Al Tisav L'matzimosav. Do not have a taiva. Do not yearn for all of his tasty food. V'hu lechem kisavim. Because it is the bread of lies, of falsehood. Because a lot of the times, well, what does Pirkei Avos say? Pirkei Avos warns us. Do not become overly, this is Al Tisvada L'Rashus. Rashus means the government authority. Do not become overly familiar, overly friendly with government officials. Because they'll be nice to you when it's in their interests. And when it's not in their interest, they'll drop you. And then if the other side gains power, you'll be an enemy, etc. You know, be polite to everybody, be menschlich to everybody, have derech eretz with everybody. But don't feel you can form a warm relationship with a moshel, because a moshel will turn on you. So lechem kesavim simply means that the hospitality is a false hospitality, because right now you're serving their interests, but then they'll drop you. Now that's the first thing. Now the next thing seems to be a new statement. Again, I'll go back. Al tiga lahashir. So tiga is miyageya, to work hard. Do not labor to become wealthy, meaning don't put all your kochos in for material wealth. Mi bi nasecha chadal. From your understanding, cease, meaning stop trying to make all sorts of plans how I'm going to make a lot of money. Because wealth doesn't last. And it says here, hatoif einecha bo, you blink your eyes in a millisecond, v'enena, and the wealth isn't there anymore. Ki aso yaselo kenafayim, it will have wings like a bird that flies away, kenesher, like an eagle, yo'uf hashamayim. Now, before we even get to the Gra, let me just remind you that the Gemara in Megillah seems to take this pasuk out of context, and it does not learn that this pasuk is referring to wealth, but this pasuk is referring to Torah knowledge. That Torah knowledge you have to constantly chazer and review and go over again and again and again. Because if you blink your eyes, in the blink of an eye, you can forget everything, and your Torah knowledge is going to fly away. So although in the pshat of this pasuk, it is referring, of course, to material wealth, because that's what the pasuk is saying, al tigal lahashir, but the next pasuk is specifically referring to Torah knowledge, that you need constant vigilance. A person can forget. A person can forget very, very easily. Okay. I'll just read a few more psukim, then I'll go back. Al tilcham esla. All right. So far we have two unrelated ideas. One is, be careful when you eat with a king. Okay. The second seemingly unrelated idea is, don't put a lot of effort into trying to make money, because you're going to lose it anyway. Now we have a third idea, which seems to reiterate being careful who you eat with, but instead of a king, it switches gears, and it says, Al tilcham es lechem ra'ayin. Ra'ayin is a stingy person, a person who begrudges doing chesed. Maybe because he's poor, but lav dafka, even if he's rich. Right, he's watching, you know, how many pieces of bread did you have? Three, four, you know, whatever it is. What do they say? There was a very, very wealthy fellow. He was the wealthiest person in the world. This is before there were cell phones. And he installed a payphone in his house. You know, the old payphones. If someone had to make a phone call, they'd have to put in, you know, a quarter or whatever. I guess that's how you become the wealthiest person in the world. Now, there is a principle in halacha like this. There actually is a principle in halacha, which is not talking about a ra'ayin, but this is called se'uda she'eina maspekes labala. That means you're not allowed to eat a meal at someone's house if you know that they really can't afford it. So, for example, if they're very poor, usually that'll be they're poor, and you know that if you have a piece of chicken, they're not going to eat chicken, or one of their kids isn't going to have chicken, or whatever. I mean, the mice, it's interesting that what's our hechsher not to follow that, because I bedavka know no cases where that happens. I mean, there are, Baruch Hashem, Yerushalayim, there are generous tzaddikim who are that poor that if there's a guest that's having chicken, either one of the kids won't have chicken, or sometimes the balabayas will disguise it. I mean, it's not going to be an open thing, but, you know, what's the hedger for us to eat there? Now, that's a good question. They're mochel, okay, but mochel b'leiv shalem, but there is a concept in halacha that if they really cannot afford to feed you, then they're doing it because of embarrassment or humiliation. So in a sense, it's kind of a form of gezeila for you to take something that they're really not in a position to give. Now here, we're not talking about a poor person. We're talking about a person who's not generous, a person who's stingy, a person who's selfish. But there's a similar type of idea. He's having you over for whatever reason, but he really does not want you to take full advantage of what he's offering. So when you sense that somebody is a ra'ayin, either don't eat there or minimize what you eat there. And the reason is, ki kamo sha'ar binafsho. It is like a storm, a tempestuous storm inside of his mind when he sees you eating and drinking. Achol v'shaso yomar lach. He'll tell you, eat and drink. V'libo ba'alima. But his heart isn't there. And therefore, pitcha achalta, when you eat the bread there, tikiyena, you'll have to vomit it later, meaning you're not going to have any bracha. V'shichata devarecha ha'ne'imim. And you will destroy all the sweet words. Meaning, if you had a friendship, the friendship dies because you've taken advantage of the hospitality of somebody who really did not want to offer that hospitality. So you have an achrayah. We have an achrayah. So, I mean, on one hand, we're supposed to judge people kavzchus, so I'm not supposed to assume that somebody is a ra'ayah. On the other hand, maybe it's a suffix, it should be machif, I don't know, but there is kind of a bit less, but if it's clear to you that really doesn't like it, you know, if you ask for a second, you want a second? All right, you know, when you get the impression that it's not appreciated, then you need to be aware of it. You need to be aware of it. Okay, so far, therefore, according to the simple meaning of the psukim, in these first eight psukim, we simply have three somewhat unrelated ideas. One is, be careful when you're eating with a king, because they'll turn against you. Number two, don't spend too much time and effort in trying to make a lot of money or becoming rich, because wealth has a way, material wealth, has a way of flying away. And number three, do not take advantage of the hospitality of somebody who is not offering it b'lev shalem. You know, they have an interesting maysa about the opposite of a true tovayin, where a Chassidus Rebbe once came to a place and he needed a place to eat or stay. So he was directed to a certain home, and the Balabba said, I'm happy to have you, but you have to know you have to pay $100 a day, because I don't give hospitality for free. So the Rebbe was quite shocked, but he had no choice. He had no other place to go to. So he goes and, you know, he had to pay. He had to somehow pay $100 a day, etc. He was there for a week or 2 weeks, and everything was very nice. The food was great, and the room was good, and there was svarim to learn, and there was even a mikveh. Everything that he needed was there. But he's one, and the person seemed like a tzaddik, but the Rebbe was wondering, I mean, it's a big tzaddik, but why does he charge $100 a day? So at the end of the 2 weeks, the Rebbe left, and the Rebbe thanked his host. And the host gave him an envelope with $1,400 or rubles, whatever the unit. Give him back all the money. He says, Chas v'Shalom, do you think I would charge money for this? Of course, it's a great mitzvah. Here's the money back. So the Rebbe said, thank you, that's even a bigger chesed. But well, why did you tell me it was $100 and I paid you? He said, because if you wouldn't charge, you would be so reluctant to take advantage of things. You'd say, oh, I'm costing the Balabayas money, but when you pay, I'm going to eat. I'm sure. Rebbe wasn't from Gushim, but the way people think, if I'm paying for it, I'm going to take full advantage. Like when people go to Pesach hotels, right? They have like meals 10 times a day. Now, you're not even hungry, but if you're paying, you know, of course I'm going to get my money's worth. Right? So this was the opposite. This was a tovayin, who so much wanted to be sure that the person would take the maximum hospitality shayach, he even created a strategy where, oh, you're paid for it, so therefore you'll take, and therefore I'll, you know, etc. All right, now, but be this as it may, the problem is, of course, according to, number one, according to the Pashat Pshat, these pshat were not connected to each other. And number two, the simple pshat is keneged chazal, because chazal learned that when you blink your eye, it flies away, is not referring at all to material wealth. It's referring to Torah knowledge. But how does that fit the hemshech of the psukim, which it says, "Al tiga la hashir," don't work to become wealthy. Okay, Alright, so because of this, the Gra learns that all of the eight units is referring to Talmud Torah, and it's referring to proper motivations for learning and improper motivations for learning. And he starts off with the idea that, it's really, I mean, this idea is really straight from Aristotle, but the Rambam adopted it from Aristotle, and that is, when you evaluate something, there are three ways that you evaluate it. There is something that is practical, meaning it's useful. There is something that is pleasant, and there is something that is good. In fact, this spells out the word tam. Something has tam. Tam has taste. So the tes is tov. It's intrinsically good. Ayin is orev. It is sweet. And mem is mo'il. It is practical. So something can be all three, or one or the other. So for example, let's take very, very bitter medicine. So very bitter medicine is not sweet. It's bitter. But it's tov. It's intrinsically good because it gives me my health. That's even better than mo'il, because it's not like a hammer mo'il, but it gives me life. Life is the very way that I serve Hashem. You take a hammer. A hammer is not sweet, and a hammer is not good, but it's mo'il. It's something that helps me in the practicalities of life. Orev, well, something like Torah is really all three. Torah is intrinsically good, it's sweet, and it also helps you practically in terms of knowing what to do. But there are many things, unfortunately, that it might be sweet in the short term, but they're neither practically helpful, nor are they intrinsically good, like most of the taivas and entertainments of the world. A person might get some momentary enjoyment out of it, sweet, but it's really like poison to the neshama. So with Torah, the Gra says like this: with Torah, a person might have three different motivations for how he connects to Torah learning. If he learns for kavod and gedula, which is taka shelo lishman, that still counts for something, learning for kavod, then he's learning because of the sweetness, the immediate short-term gratification I get, that people will think that I'm a great guy. That is learning Torah because it's arev, because it's sweet. Now, the second motivation, but we're going up to higher motivations, is a person learns Torah because they genuinely want to know halacha. I mean, that's obviously a very, very important thing. I learn Torah to get practical knowledge. So I'm learning Hilchos Shabbos, so I'll know how to keep Shabbos properly. That is learning Torah because it's mo'il. It has practical benefit. And now I serve Hashem. Now that is a much higher madrega than Shelo Lishma. That is a Bechina of Lishma, because I'm learning Torah to serve God. But that's also tainted in a sense, because when you're learning Torah only for the purpose, like this is a problem we have with halacha kolalim sometimes, when you're learning Torah only for the purpose of knowing what to do, then you will often not have an incentive to be ma'ayin in things that are not directly pertinent to a halacha l'maisa. So for example, if there's a machlokes, Rashi and Tosos, but the Shulchan Aruch, let's say, and the Ramah and all the Nosei Kelim paskin like Tosfos, you're not going to think about how the Pnei Yeshua is Miyashiv Rashi from all of Tosfos' kashas, because hey, we don't pass like Rashi, so forget about it and the like. And as a result, paradoxically, it's interesting paradox. Rabbi Yashiv pointed this out quite a lot. Paradoxically, in your interest to only get bottom line practical conclusions, you will often tend to be superficial, and as a result, your ability to even apply the halacha to any situation that is not beferish is going to be weakened, because without the eon of knowing all of the different swaras, you will not be able, I don't mean, I'm thinking about myself, we would not be able to apply. Right? What does it mean, psak halacha? People say, oh, okay, can I paskin from the Mishnah Berurah? Well, it all depends what you mean. If the Mishnah Berurah says a certain thing, I can say the Mishnah Berurah says a certain thing. That's fine. But that's not a psak. That just happens to be that you read what the Mishnah Berurah says. assuming you understood it, which is also an issue, you could say, this is what he says. The concept, when someone is a posek, the concept of psak, it's not just a question, he remembers what the Mishnah Berurah says. It's the ability to apply different opinions to a situation, medama milsa la milsa, something that's not befeirish. And that depends on knowing all the different shitas, knowing all the different svaras, and knowing when there is a basis to be makil because, you know, shasatchak or what is it? All of these, what you call mitigating circumstances, that's a psak. Now that doesn't come from just learning halacha l'maisa, so to speak. That comes only when you go back and you know all of these svaras. So even though it's true, this is what the Gemara points this out, even though it's true that learning Torah for practical, pragmatic grounds is certainly, on one level, a very good thing. You're not learning it for kavod, you're learning it to know how to serve Hashem. But if you limit yourself to the practical aspect, your learning will often become superficial, and you will in fact not know how to apply the Torah to situations that are not befeirish. In fact, you may not even be able to know what the Mishnah Berurah or the Rambam or whatever it would be, whatever they're referring to, if one does not know. Which means this dichotomy that we have between the posek and the lamdim, although it does exist, l'maisa, but it's fundamentally a false dichotomy, because one cannot be a truly great posek. Anyway, you could be a person with a good memory who remembers a lot of halachas. That's very true. But to be a, I hate to use these rankings, but to be a class A posek, I hate to talk about it that way, but to be a class A posek, you have to be a lamda. That's why we talk about Rebbe Yashiv, where it was such a good example. Rebbe Yashiv was class A posek under any definition. But he basically said over and over again, he didn't even like the halacha kovel in the lad. He said, you do Gemara, you do Rishonim over and over and over again, and then you can kind of look at the poskim almost kalachayat. In other words, once, if you truly knew Gemara and Rishonim, you know, at the highest level of understanding, you could go through the Shulchan Aruch like, you know, in 2 minutes, because it's just kind of giving you a final hakra on the different things that you know. But you know, you worked out all of the pratim. So he was not in favor of the idea of a Mishnah Berurah kol or the like. He once made a bit of a sarcastic remark. He says, "Oh, are they going to do a Tzenurena kol?" Tzenurena was the Yiddish. Although it's interesting, one thing really intrigued me. I just read a little Meister once that somebody was talking about Rebbe Yashiv's Hasmada. That you know, every year from Purim, you know, like the halacha says, from he would learn Hilchos Pesach 30 days, you know, every year. I say he did it 100 times, but you know, every year he would do Hilchos Pesach. So, and you know, he would lock himself. There's a shul in Meir Sharim Oel Sarah. That was his place. He would like lock himself in the shul. You could see him from the window, but he wouldn't answer the door when he was in that shul. I mean, later in his life, by the time you know. I know, you know, I mean, he was learning in his house, but for many, many years, 30, 40, 50 years, he was in that shul all day, Oel Sarim. So somebody said, I was able to see, his back was to the window, and I could see what he was learning, and I saw that he had a Mishnah Berurah, Taka, and what was he learning? Because he figured, Hilchos Pesach has so many lumdish simanim, taruvos chametz, and you know, really, really, you know, lumdish stuff. He was learning. So, and I don't even know what he was doing. He says he was on the first staff of the Mishnah Berurah that says you got to learn Hilchos Pesach 30 days before Pesach. There's not much more on that page. And he was looking at that page. He says, if he said, for 5 hours, he was looking at that page. He says, I don't even know what it was on that page that he could be learning. But so apparently, you know, so like, even in like the what we might think the relatively simpler halachas, you know, he saw like so much to learn and the like. But this is the point. So again, so we have learning Torah Shelo Lishma is the bechina of arev, sweet. It gives you some immediate gratification, but it's not enduring. Learning Torah for practical purposes is on some level a good thing, but it can lead to superficiality. and inability to really apply the Torah to new situations because you don't have the depth of understanding of the different shittas. Again, I keep on going back to Rav Elyashiv with this because Rav Elyashiv for many years was a Dayan. He was a Dayan. He was not a Rosh Hashiva, he was a Dayan. And even after he left, and he left because of a whole scandal with Rav Goren in the 1970s, because of a very big controversy about Mamzeres, and he felt he could not work in the basement anymore. But still, the Rabbanut would send him candidates to be tested if they're roy to be Dayanim. He would give tests to people. So he often had this problem. Dayanim candidates, he had two candidates. One like knows, and to be a Dayan is a very hard thing. Eben Ezra Choshen Mishpat. One knows like Eben Ezra Choshen Mishpat by heart. He knows every Sif Katan, every Beit Shmuel, and Chokas Machoket, and Shach, and Sma. But the other didn't really have such a memory of it. He didn't remember every last thing, but he had a greater Havana in the Gemara and the Rishonim. So Yashiv said there is absolutely no question that the better Dayan is the second one, not the first one. Because the second one will know where to look. He doesn't remember how the Beit Shmuel was Machriya. So he'll look it up. In other words, those are bedafi the things you can look up. I don't remember, does he say A or B? But when you have all the swaras, you know exactly what the issue is, what the shaila is, what the nekudas are. You've thought it all out. So then you can look up and see what the final answer is, as opposed to somebody who memorizes everything. But without all the swaras, he won't necessarily be able to realize that this case is a little different than that case, right? So Rabbi Yashiv held that the mastery of the lumdus was actually more important than pure memory. At the same time, I have to say, he didn't disparage pure memory. He used to say that the day that he would not remember a Sif Katan in the Shach, that's what he said, he says it's the day he would stop paskening. He said he would not pasken if he didn't remember where we're at. So you need both, but if you have to choose between the two, he said a mastery of the Gemara and the Rishonim was a more important quality. Alright. So finally, we cut out, so that's Arev, and then we have Moel, and then Tov is a person learns Torah just to learn the Torah, to know the Torah. L'shem Shemayim, and also, and actually this goes back to Reb Chaim Volozhiner. Reb Chaim Volozhiner says, what does it mean to learn Torah L'shma? So he says, learning Torah L'shma doesn't mean L'shem Hashem, because then it would have said L'shmo. Learning Torah L'shma doesn't refer to any particular kavana you have. It means I'm learning Torah to understand it the best that I can possibly do. Das heißt, Lima HaTorah L'shma. This is Rav Chaim Volozhiner. Now the Baal HaTanya argues. The Baal HaTanya does say why it's feminine, as he doesn't say clearly. But L'shma is L'shem Deveikus in the Shechina. The Shechina is feminine. So that was a big machlokas between Hasidim and Misnagdim. Based on this, as what is the concept of limud hatayra lishma and the like. So the Gra says, therefore, that if we understand there are three reasons why one might learn Torah, and they correspond to Arev, Moel, and Tov, the Tov, Arev, Moel, these are what the psukim are trying to, these are what the psukim are trying to address. He says, the Moshel, the ruler, is a reference to the Yetzer Hara, because the Yetzer Hara is described as that which rules us, right? It says by Adam Mechava, "Hu yimshol bach," that if you're not careful, the Yetzer Hara will rule you. Lochal is a double verb; it both means eating bread, because Torah is called lechem, because it gives you nutrition, and Torah is also called milchama, because we talk about the milchama of the Torah. So the pasuk starts off, when you sit to learn Torah with your Yetzer Hara, meaning to say, when your motivation is for kavod, you need to try to understand that. You need to try to purify yourself. It may be difficult, and even if you can't get rid of that, you learn anyway. But l'maisa, your avayda is, try to understand and try to restrict the arrogance and the gaiva and the kavod that you have. And ultimately, it says you put a knife in your throat. And that, the Vilna Gaon says, is a bit of an expression that says, if you're learning for kavod or for aisher, give yourself musr, so to speak. Remember the day of death and become humble and try to learn l'shem shemayim. And then it mentions, do not desire this goal, because this is called lechem kizavim. It is the Torah of falsehood. And he explains two things. He says that when you learn shalol l'shma, l'shem kavod, number one, there is a pagam in the Torah you're learning, b'shas maisa. B'shas maisa, there's a pagam. But number two, it will also not remain with you. The Torah that you learn for kavod, you're going to lose. And he says that these two ideas are merumas in this pasuk gimel. Al tisav, do not have a taiva for the tastiness of the kavod that you'll get, because that is like poisonous food, b'shas maisa. B'shas maisa, it's poisonous. And the second thing is, it's kisavim, it'll be a disappointment later. Do you remember the difference? The difference between sheker and chazav, the Vilna Gaon said in a few places, although the word sheker isn't used here. Sheker is something that is false at the very beginning. Chazav is, it turns out to be a disappointment. So, let's take a shvua. If I swear I was in a certain place today and I wasn't, that is a sheker. At the time I said it, it's a sheker. If I swear I will go somewhere tomorrow, so at the time I swore, it's not a lie, maybe I will. If I don't, that's not called sheker, that's called kazav. That's called good. So the phrase sheker v'kazav, which we use synonymously, sheker v'kazav, are actually two different things. Sheker is referring to a past or a present lie, and kazav is referring to something that doesn't turn out the way it should have turned out. In fact, in modern Hebrew, the word for a disappointment is an achzava. Same word as kazav, achzava. So the Vilna Gaon says that when you learn l'shem pinias, for your ulterior motives, so number one, the Torah itself is tainted. It doesn't bring you close to God. Number two, it's lechem kisavim, it disappoints because it doesn't stay with you. In effect, it's a self-defeating prophecy. You're learning because I want all the kavod, but forget it, it's not going to stay with me. And he says, this is the meaning of the pasuk, Yiras Hashem, another pasuk in Tehillim, Yiras Hashem Tahora Omedes La'ad. When there's Yiras Hashem, you're learning Torah L'shem Shamayim, L'shma. So there are two milas of Yiras Hashem Torah. Tahora, it's pure at the time you're learning it. And second of all, it endures. Omedes la'ad. Yiras Hashem tahora, omedes la'ad. And conversely, therefore, when you don't learn lishma, then the matamosav do not really benefit you. And number two, it's lechem kizavim. Okay. So that's pasuk aleph to gimel. That refers to the person who learns Torah because it is sweet, meaning, I don't mean the sweetness of the haridna, but the sweetness because of kavod and osher. Now, the next verse is referring to the person who learns Torah for really a good reason on some level. He learns Torah because it's practical, meaning he wants to know, how do I keep Shabbos? How do I keep kosher? Right? That is very obviously, it's very important. But here, it starts off the following. Al tiga lahashir, which we thought meant don't work hard to increase wealth, it actually means don't work hard to become wealthy in Torah knowledge. Wait a second, that sounds totally wrong. Don't work hard to become wealthy in Torah knowledge? Well, the Vilna Gaon certainly didn't live by that. That's what I'm saying. So the Vilna Gaon says this is what it actually means. It means a person wants to become wealthy in knowing many, many halachos without understanding the background, without understanding the significance, without having a good havana of them. The Vilna Gaon said, in other words, he's learning only for the practical benefit of knowing these halachas. So he says, one should not do that. One should not do that. Because one needs to learn with Havana and understanding. Because that's what the Pasuk is saying. If you're miyageya to become rich by just accumulating a lot of facts, mibi nascha chadol, your understanding will cease. In other words, you won't understand what you're learning. Now again, we're not referring to the idea that in the short run I need to know. I mean, in the short run I have to know how to daven, I have to know how to put on tefillin, I have to know how to keep Shabbos, I have to know. And to say that I'm not going to know what's muktzah and what's not muktzah until I learn all of the sugyas in Maseches Shabbos and Beya, that's not going to work. I got to keep Shabbos, you know, next week. So everybody's moda. I mean, everybody's moda. The Gra is not talking about that. Everybody's moda that a person must set aside time to know what to do, even if you don't understand all the background and everything else. But we're talking about, where do you put your energies in limud? Where do you put your storm? If you have hours to learn, right? Where do I put my energy? So the Gra is saying, do not put your energy in learning a lot of halachas. Because the truth of the matter is, it's not even necessary. In other words, like this. Al Slimat HaTaira, the ikar is the Havana of the sukkahs. For practicalities, you don't have to know everything in the Mishnah Berurah. In other words, not everything is Nogeya Lamaisa Mamish. Many things are not Nogeya Lamaisa Mamish, etc. So the question is, are you learning to know what to do, or is the whole basis of your learning the accumulation of a lot of halachic rulings? The Vilna Gaon Shita is that you need to know what to do, for sure. But one's learning should not be to accumulate many, many halachic rulings without the Havana. Some do argue. I mean, I know we have Mishnah Berurah, Daf Yomis and everything else, and you know, that has Das Kamo Gedolim. And certainly all learning is better than not learning. Yeah, that's absolutely the case. But at least the Gra is miyayates that one should learn by Havana. Now again, I don't want to give my speeches I'm always giving about the Derech Avi and the Yeshivas. The Gra was not saying, therefore, the ideal learning is the typical Yeshiva Shashir that we have. For sure, he would not be in favor of that either. Although that has a role to teach us how, give us a Derech, so to speak. Okay, but again, the Gra is not talking about people who don't yet have a derech. He's talking, the Gra is really addressing Talmidei Chachamim, some degree. So maybe we're looking at people above us. But the derech halimud is a derech where the derech of Havana is not the same thing as the derech of just looking up, you know, many, many different things. Derech of Havana is to think things out, to understand, you know, the basis of the machlokas of the fundamental Rishonim, and to understand how it goes through the Gemara, and then to think through what would the practical differences be l'maisa. They say that great Rabbi Yashiv, for example, again, go back to Rabbi Yashiv because he was such an example of this. Rabbi Yashiv could answer Shilas almost immediately. Like, you never had a situation where, you know, I have to think about it. Just like, you know, no matter what the Shilas was, he answered it right away. So obviously, you know, he had all the knowledge there. But Shlomo Zalman said, that listen, I mean, he said, listen, what he knows, I know. He said, I mean, I also know the Shach and the Taz. He says, but when someone gives me a new Shaila, I have to think about how to apply all of these things to the new Shaila. Why doesn't Rebbe Yashiv have to think how to apply? Again, see, this is such a discussion that's so above us, you know, but you know. But he said, the raw material, the raw data, of Shlomo Zalman said, and is, you know, I'm the same. He said, I have the same raw data. So why can't I answer the Shaila right away? He said, because when Rebbe Yashiv would learn, he would think out consciously, what are the practical differences? In other words, every Shaila you asked him, he already thought of. He thought of the Shaila, because he thought of what is the difference between Taisus and the Ramban. And mainly when you asked him, oh yeah, but, you know, so he was never asked a new Shaila, because it was always something he already worked out that a chelik of his havara was to always ask, what is the nafkamina between this approach and that approach? And that is the ultimate test of how well you understand a chakira or a lama. Sometimes people have chakiras and they say, what's the nafkamina? Right? You know, I know the famous, it's a joke in Tells. In the old Tells or Derech, not so much today, but Tells in Europe, people used to make fun of it. They would compare Tells and Bris, because that's two different. In Tells, they would sometimes have chakiras, which were very, very subtle. You really couldn't understand the difference between this side of it and that side of it. So they would say to somebody would say to a Telzer, he says, what's the nafkamina? He'd say, Pasha, nafkamina is, if a person is Makadosh and Isha on a Tanai, he says, Hariyat Bukadeshishly on the Tanai, then it's this side of the Chakira. If it's this side of the Chakira, it's a good marriage. If it's that side, Mamish no Gael was, every Chakira has a Nafkamina if you're Makadosh on a Tanai. Right, so that's what they used to say. That's a Nafkamina. But that's not a real Nafkamina. That's a fake Nafkamina. The real Nafkamina is in the Chakira itself. And that's how you answer. That's how you answer. Answer Shilas. So therefore, the Vilna Gaon was against, what you might say. In fact, he says it in a lot of places. I mean, he often interprets Pesukim in several places to make similar points. He was against the concept of Kitzurei Dinim, learning, you know, books of Halacha that tell you the Halacha L'maisa, where you don't go back to the Gemara itself and go back to the Gemara and the Rishayim. Again, I want to emphasize, to practically know how I'm going to keep Shabbos next week, I certainly need those Svarim, 1,000%. But one would not be Koveya, their main Kaviyas in learning, in those Svarim. Alright, and that's what it says, because if you're Miyageya, he makes another point too, why is it called Miyageya? This is very interesting. He says, although the Maisa, we praise Yegiya B'Torah, that's a good thing. But he says, Miyageya connotes working when you don't get satisfaction. So he says, when you're just accumulating Piskei Halachos, that's Yegiya, that's real hard work. Because you don't get the geschmack of understanding. So it's interesting, it's the opposite of what you're doing. He's actually saying, don't learn in a way that makes you do laborious, hard work that's not enjoyable. He says, when you try to get Havana, then you enjoy, and that carries you through, and the like. And that's what Chazal mean in the next pasuk. The Gra says that you blink your eye and it flies away. It's taka going on Divrei Torah, and it's making the point that when one's learning is superficial and not rooted in Havana, it's very easily forgotten. See, that which we understand stays in our mind. That which we just memorized doesn't stay in our mind. And that's Atoya Feinecha Bay Vienenu, Ki Aso Yasolo Kinafayim Kinesha. Now, he makes another point on this pasuk. That what does it say? Atoyev einecha bo ve'enenu. You will blink your eyes ve'enenu, and it's not there anymore. Then it says also yaselo kenafayim. The Torah that you learned this way will make have wings, and kinesher yo'af hashamayim, and like the eagle, it'll just go into the stratosphere, just fly away from you. So there's a redundancy, right? After it says it'll have kenafayim, why does it say kenesher yo'af hashamayim? So the Gra says that there are three parts of the Torah. There is Torah shebichsav, the written Torah. There is Torah shebal peh, called the Mishnah, Gemara, Halacha, the Torah shebal peh. And then there is what is called sodos, the secrets of the Torah, the Kabbalah, the mysteries of the Torah. And the like. So he says, let me see how he's interpreting this. Hatoyif einecha bo ve'enenu, you blink your eyes and it's not there anymore. That refers to the Torah that you see with your eyes. That is the Torah Shebichsav. Now, of course, today, obviously, everything's written down, so but at least initially, it's a time, remember, it's a time Shlomo HaMelech is writing. Whatever was Torah Shebaal Peh was still Baal Peh. So the phrase, you blink your eye and it disappears, that is a phrase that is mechuvan to Torah Shebichsav. Okay? Then it says, Aso Yasolo Kenafayim, it will fly away. That is Torah Shebaal Peh. And again, the Gra says, Ki Mishnahi Beli Tam, like Halachos, without a reason, Kal L'Shachacha Mehera. It is very easy to forget it right away. As opposed to the Gemara, he says, of course, I think the Gra was more optimistic than our case, but the Gra says, Gemara, Kishi Odeya, once you know Gemara, once you know the reasons for things, Ain L'Shachacha Mehera, you're not going to forget it. Halvai v'halvai, but he says shekal davar taimai v'nimuko imai, because things have reasons. When things have, but first of all, you understand this is also true. Because no, but okay, I mean, listen, you have to chazer, that's true. But here is the thing: the reason why there is a reason why reasons allow you to retain information, because reasons give you an organizational principle. In other words, halacha has many, many rules. So there might be 20, 30, 40, 50 rules. It's hard to memorize 50 rules. But when you know the svaras, then there might only be three rules you have to keep in your head. And if you know these rules, then you'll figure out, oh, cases A through E will be, or A through through O will be governed by this yisod, and cases P through Z will be governed by this yisod. So there actually is less that you have to memorize, because the different details are governed by the intersection of principles. I mean, that is why klalim are so important, but klalim only come with havana. If one doesn't have havana, you're not really sure what the klal is that governs all of these different rules. And the nesher is another reference of the sodos, because the eagle flies very high, that refers to the sodos of Torah. That are beyond, that's right. So that's how we learn. Okay. Alrighty. So according to the Gra, Psukim Aleph through Hey are dealing with the negative reasons, and not the negative, or the suboptimal. I won't call the second one negative, but the suboptimal reason for learning Torah. One is for Osher V'Kavod, which is called Arev, and the other is for practical knowledge, which is good on some level, called Mo'il, but it has its drawbacks. Now, Pasuk Vav is really stating a directive to the person who wants to learn Torah Lishma. So you're a very good you're in a good place. I want to learn Torah Lishma. Just again, Rav Chaim Volozhiner says that means to understand the Torah. So what warnings are you giving me? The Shlomo HaMelech is giving warnings. So what do you have to tell me? I'm perfect, right? What is wrong? So therefore, the Pasuk switches to what type of teacher you need to find. And that is, do not eat bread or fight the wars of Torah with a Ra'ayin. And a Ra'ayin is a teacher who is selfish or stingy in wanting to share his knowledge, or the teacher himself learns Shelo Lishma for Osher V'Kavod, because once again, you are affected by the nature of the teacher. If the teacher doesn't want to teach, then Mimela, you're at a disadvantage. And even if he wants to teach, the Torah that he will be communicating, meaning a teacher who teaches Shelo Lishma, that Torah becomes Nifkam even when it is absorbed by a student who is trying to learn it Lishma. So it's a very interesting idea that you're mechuyev to worry about the state of your teacher, state of your Rebbe. The same way that a Rebbe has to be concerned about the spiritual nature of the Talmud has this achrayas as well. Okay, so that is what this unit is referring to. This unit is referring to the three motivations that a person has for a limud HaTorah. But Bederech Agav, you also see the Gra Shita. You know, if you take, for example, the Bir HaGra in the Shulchan Aruch, right? In fact, this is the one work. This is the only halachic work that the Vilna Gaon wrote himself. The Vilna Gaon wrote Sifrei Kabbalah himself. And the Vilna Gaon wrote the Bir HaGra in Shulchan Aruch himself, although Talmidim added things. Everything else, every other thing, Mishlei we know, every other thing you have from the Gra was people writing over Talmidim, except for the Hagos. The Hagos were just the Hagos, that's from the Gra's own Gemara. That wasn't written for publication. That was, obviously, that was the Gra himself. So the Bir HaGra is the Gra's own work. So what does the Bir HaGra do? Bir HaGra takes every halacha in the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, and shows you, he's very brief, very bekitzer, but he shows you where in the Gemara it's from, and he'll say, and this is a machlokes Rashi and Tosfos, and he'll say that the Mechaber paskins like Rashi for the following reason. Right? In other words, what is the Gemara trying to do? To show you that each halacha in the Shulchan Aruch has to be traced back to the Gemara. Now, because it's very much bekitzer, and because it requires really knowledge of Shas, so people don't look at it so much, right? I mean, how many times has a Rebbe said in a shir the Bir HaGra in the Shulchan Aruch? But real gedolim, used to be koveya sedarim to learn Shulchan Aruch with the Bir HaGra. There are even svarim to try to explain the Bir HaGra, exactly how the Gra learned sugyas and the like. Okay. Now let's just skip a little down.
Sometimes a person will learn a lot more if he has one of these first two kavanos than if he's just the Shem Shemayim. So yeah. Would that override quantity?
I think that, we can't get away from Chazal's statement that a person should learn shelo lishma, shemitoch shelo lishma, yavo lishma. So there is a kind, granted, Tosfos introduces a certain type of shelo lishma that you actually shouldn't learn, which is a very big chiddush. Tosfos says, if you're learning lakanter, that means you're learning to humiliate other people. I'm learning so I can destroy that guy. That already, you shouldn't even learn. But if we're talking about the motivations of Osher B'Kavod. I mean, listen, Kavod could be anything. When a person learns because he wants to, become a Magid Shir, whatever it is. I mean, on some level, that's either, Osher maybe is too strong of a term in terms of salary, but he wants a Parnassa, or he wants Kavod. Right? It happens. That's not an uncommon motivator at some level. So certainly, but on that we say mitoch shelo lishma, bav lishma. So one should learn, one should definitely learn. And then the Torah itself brings you closer to Hashem, and you eventually will be closer. But the Gra is warning you that Hagam, that you should learn, but that Torah is lechem kezavim. It may not stay with you that much, but still, better to do that than not to do that. It's only lekanter that we say it's actually better not to learn. Okay. Now, let's skip a little bit. I'll just read a few psukim. Look at Pasuk Yud Gimel. Al timna minar musar. Do not withhold from the young man musar, right? Let's say a person has a child and they don't want to be tough on their child. Let the child do whatever he wants. Kisakenu b'shevet lo yamus. If you hit him with a stick, he's not going to die. Now again, if you remember, Shlomo HaMelech in a few places does talk about physical punishment. The most famous pasuk is not this one, but it makes the same idea. Chosech shifto sonei beno, which even in English is a well-known proverb. Spare the rod and hate the child. Right? The Puritans were very fond of that. That they spare the rod. Now, the Gra himself says on that shevet is understood largely symbolically. Gra says, hit your child with a shoelace. Meaning, yes, discipline him. Don't let things be ignored. But it does not refer to brutality, it does not refer to pain. And I think I mentioned before, a very interesting maaser with the Bussner Rebbe. This is the Bussner Rebbe who was Nifter, and now the son of the Bussner Rebbe. This is Rav Levi Yitzchok Horowitz. Zichrono Livracha, very, very great, great man. I knew him very, very well. I lived in Boston. I used to, me and 100 other people, it wasn't anything unique, at his house many, many Shabbos. And he would tell the story of his father, who was the first Bussner Rebbe. So Boston is not a city in the Ukraine or something. I thought it's kind of interesting that, you know, I guess the Rebbe from Ukraine that lives in the same city. No, Boston was invented in Boston, because after World War I, there were many Hasidim, refugee Hasidim, who no longer had a connection to their Rebbes in Europe. So they gathered around a man who became their Rebbe, but they still had allegiance to their main Rebbe. So, for example, an old Bussner Chassid could be a Gera Chassid, could be a Chabad Chassid, before the Chabad Rebbeim came, etc. But so that was the father, and then the son was Rav Levi Yitzchok Horowitz, who spent half of the year in Har Nof and half of the year in Boston. So that was the one that I knew. So he used to say that his father would hit him if he misbehaved. His father would hit him, but his father would always wait 24 hours before he hit him. Because the father said, if I discipline a child, it is because it is for the benefit of the child, not because I'm angry and I lose my temper. So memela, I have to be absolutely sure that I'm not angry when I discipline my child, because then the kavana is for the benefit of the child and not because I had a bad day or I'm upset. Because if you yell, scream, it doesn't have to be hitting, by the way, even yelling, screaming, saying harsh words at a child because you had a bad day at the office and you're tense or you're tired, it is a form of onas devarim. You're hurting somebody. See, parents have a heter to hit and punish and discipline a child when they're doing it for the tayeles of chinuch. But when we don't do it for the tayeles of chinuch, the obligations we have towards our children are the same obligations we have towards any other person. Onas devarim, lashon hara, right? All of these different things. In fact, based on a famous maaser with the Steigler, what you do to little children might be worse than what you do to an adult. Remember, I've mentioned this maaser before. It's a very famous maaser that the Steigler once showed up when he was very old and he couldn't walk, and he walked like 2 miles. It took 3 or 4 hours. He showed up at a bar mitzvah in Bnei Brak, and everybody was shocked. The Steigler walks in. I mean, they didn't even know him. They certainly wouldn't have expected him to come. And he goes over to the boy, bar mitzvah boy, and he exchanges 5 words, and the boy nods, and the Steigler gives the boy a kiss and a bracha, and then he trudges home for another, you know, 2 or 3 hours to get home. And everyone runs over to the kid and says, what did he say, what was it about? So the kid said the following story. He says, 4 years ago, when he was 9 years old, he was visiting his Zaidi, who lived near the Steigler. And the shul where the Steigler goes to, Chaim Kineski goes to, is called the Letterman Shul. Not to be confused with the comedian. This is Letterman with a Dalit. The boy was carrying a very big machzor for his grandfather who couldn't see very well. And the Steigler thought it was a Gemara. And he thought the boy was going to learn during davening. So he told the boy, you know, in Rosh Hashanah, we daven, we don't, you concentrate on the tefillahs. So the boy showed him what was a machzor. So the Steigler said, ay, 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 I hurt your feelings, I insulted you, I embarrassed you. I need to ask mechila, but you're a katan. A katan cannot give mechila. So tell me when your bar mitzvah is. So the boy said, my bar mitzvah is 4 years from now, 4.5 years, Parshas Truma. So 4 years from that point, 4.5 years, Parshas Truma, the Steigler shows up at the bar mitzvah to ask the boy's mechila. The boy gave him mechila, the Steigler gave him a bracha. So what do you see from this maisa? It's such an amazing story. The amazing story is, what you do to a katan can be a bigger problem than what you do to a gadol. I do something to you. You're a nice guy. You'll forgive me. You'll be mocha, hopefully. But I do something to a katan. A katan is a lav bar mechila. So if it's my child, even if it's not my child, but if it's done to be madrich the katan, certainly a parent, the emesis, even somebody else. So that's nichlal in the mitzvah of helping a Jew, in the mitzvah of chinuch for the parent, and for someone not the parent, helping a Jew go in the right derech. But if I stop embarrass my child because I'm angry, it's an amazing thing. Parents don't think of it this way. But it's mamish and avera. If the child's not bar mitzvah, it's an avera for which there's no mechila right now. And that means Yom Kippur is not mechaper, because Yom Kippur is only mechaper on Bein Adam L'Chaveiro if you have mechila. Right? So the Gra says beferish that the idea of shaven is not, you know, I take this pole and I, you know, beat my child, so to speak. But it's more of a symbolic lashon that you have to have discipline. You can't let things slide. You have to be very, very concerned. And don't be afraid your child will hate you or drop dead if you tell him, can't have that, can't do that. He's not going to melt away. Children are very strong in that way. And in fact, children crave discipline. Psychologists will tell you that sometimes a child acts up. It's hard to understand the dynamic. Because he wants the parent's attention. He wants the parent to, even negative interaction. He wants to be yelled at because at least the parent is talking to him. At least the parent notices him. There's a mussar there too, that, you know, if we would spend time noticing and interacting when the child is behaving good, he wouldn't need that negative attention. But what happens is, therefore, if the child is doing it to get attention, then fakert, then the child is welcoming that discipline. I once heard from a child psychologist a very, very interesting mashal. He says, maybe you remember that as children too, he says that for a child, growing up can sometimes be very frightening. You know, the world is a frightening place, and things are happening. The child doesn't always understand. And they need their parents to provide security. The notion that someone will take care of them. Someone will not let them go off the deep end. Someone will not let them jump off the cliff. Someone will stop them in time. So he compared, this psychologist compared life to being on a 747. And the parents are like the pilots of the 747. So how would you feel, you know, you're on a 747 going to Israel or America, and the pilot comes down the aisle and you're seating on row 25 or whatever, and he says, you know, I'm going to take a nap, can you drive the plane for a while? And even if, you know, it's autopilot, I mean, it's true, you know, nothing to worry about, it's an autopilot, it's fine, that's true, you know, a lot of the plane is on automatic pilot, literally, that's where you get the expression. But still, I think most of us would have a very, a very, very deep sense of panic. Panic. When a child is given the message, you can do whatever you want, you're in charge of the plane, that doesn't make a kid feel good. A child actually craves some type of limit, even when they complain about it. And that's what he says. He says, you give limits to your children, with love, of course. They're not going to die. And then he says, Ata b'shevet takenu. You're hitting him with a stick. You think you're so mean. Nafsho misha'ol tatzil. You say you've saved his life from Gehenna. So whatever disadvantage you're putting on him, in the long run, this is going to be much better. Now again, you have to balance this with everything else in Mishnah. Remember the famous verse, Chanoch l'nar al pi darko, to train a child according to his derech, but the parents have to be attuned to the personality of the child. So you have to take all of this into account. So yeah, you have to set limits, you have to have discipline, the child has to have guidance, but everything has to be in accordance with the essential nature of his personality. Remember too, the all important klal that Chazal give us, that with the right hand you draw near, and with the left hand you push away. With apologies to the lefties, we're simply going with the assumption that the right hand represents the dominant strong hand. that is the dominant aspect of parenting is love and bringing near. And if there's room for discipline and pushing away, and that has to be there, that should be the weaker part of the relationship, the less dominant. When the more dominant is love and caring, then the child will accept the discipline. When the more dominant is the discipline, then everything becomes makoko. So you have to take any pasuk like this, you have to keep in mind all the other sukkim as well. Okay. Now, and then we move on to the nachas, when things work well. V'ni imchacham libecha. If your heart is wise, yismach libi gam ani. I am happy as well. Remember the teaching of Chazal, that you can be jealous of everybody, but the two people you will never be jealous of are your children and your Talmidim. You will not be jealous if they surpass you. Here the Gra makes an interesting remark, or I don't know if the Gra wrote these words or Rav Menachem Mendel, but he says like this. He says, this refers to the notion that because father and son are so connected, even if the father doesn't even know what the son is doing exactly, when the son becomes a chacham, the father will feel it inside. There will be a telepathic feeling. And he says the following language, Kamo ha'eben ha'nikra magnet. I'm reading the commentary. Yeah. Like a magnet, kishi yachadchu v'shnayim. If you cut the magnet in two, kishechelko echad yisnoa, when one part of it moves, the other part will move as well. But then he says something, I'm not sure what scientific thing this is based on. Even if it is rachok miksei aret, he's describing a phenomenon where they're 1,000 miles apart. I'm not sure what that is exactly referring to. Einstein used to describe, what's the famous phrase he used to use? Spooky action at a distance. But Lamaise, I think they've established that it's not magnetism. Magnetism requires a certain proximity. But there is something in nature in which particles are related to a degree that a movement here will trigger a movement there, even though there's no communication because it's faster than the speed of light. That's what we're saying. Because in theory, information cannot go from one thing to another thing faster than the speed of light. That's Einstein's relativity theory. And yet, it was shown that this interrelationship of particles somehow, it's not communication, it's somehow immediacy. And that's the idea that a parent feels the accomplishments of the child, even if the parent is not consciously aware of it, and the like. Now, I want to show you another pasuk. Look at pasuk Chaf Dalet. I'm going to go backwards, but I want to look at pasuk Chaf Dalet first for a moment. And here, the Gra has just to show you some beautiful diyukim. Gil yogil avi tzadik. The father of a tzaddik is filled with delight, gila. V'yoleid chacham, and he who gives birth to a chacham, yismach bo, will rejoice in that. So, first of all, you see two different words for joy here. We have gila, and we have simcha. What is the difference between gila, and simcha? So the Gra says, gil is the joy of that which is constant. Constant. Right, so if I have a righteous son, I have a constant joy. Simcha is the joy of that which is chiddush, something new happening. That's why he says, yismachu hashamayim v'sogel Ha'aretz. Right? In Hashem's grandeur of creation, the heavens have simcha and the land has gila. Why? Because in the physical world under the Shemesh, Ein kol chadash tachas Hashem. Hashem's not going to make new things. So the joy of creation is that Hashem every day brings back the world. So sogel haaretz. But in Shemayim, new malachim are created, new things are created. So memela yismachu Hashemayim v'sogel haaretz. So memela, he says the following. A tzaddik is somebody who keeps mitzvahs. So Baruch Hashem, the mitzvahs don't change. So Baruch Hashem, my son is a tzaddik. He wore tefillin today, he'll wear tefillin tomorrow, he'll wear tefillin the next day, not today, but you know, except Shabbos, etc. So vis-a-vis Shmiras mitzvahs, the joy of a parent is gila, because he stays on the path. But if my son is not only a tzaddik, my son is also a chacham. A chacham is machadesh in Torah. A chacham comes up with new ideas, new insights. So it's not just the gila, Baruch Hashem, my son is on the right derech. But I have simcha, because he's machadesh, he's always machadesh and grow, etc. Now he also makes a point too, that you'll notice that in the first half of the pasuk, it describes him as Avi Tzaddik, the father of the Tzaddik. The second half says Yolid, he who gives birth. So the Gra says, this may not be the father, this may be the Rebbe. Because the Gemara tells us that Rabbo Shalim No Torah, that a Rebbe who teaches Torah to a Talmud, is Kilo, he gave birth to him. So Mimela, the Gra is pointing out that maybe a parent might not get the Simcha from the Chidushei Torah of the child, because the parent doesn't know the Chidushei Torah of the child. The Rebbe that hears the Chidushim, he's going to have Simcha. But then, right after we say that, look at the next pasuk. Yismach avicha v'imecha v'sagel yoladetecha. Okay, I hope you remember that this pasuk is recited at every bris, right? We say this out loud. We don't say it out loud, but in the paragraph where the baby is given a name, right? The person who names the baby recites a bracha. So there is this pasuk, Yismach avicha v'imecha, may your father and your mother have simcha, v'sogel yoladetecha, and the one that gave birth to you have gila. Now again, going with the Gra, which may not be what it means in the Bris Mila, that yoladetecha is Rebbe, so you'll notice an interesting reversal here. Because in the first pasuk, the gila was miyuchas to the father, and the simcha was miyuchas to the Rebbe, and the mother wasn't mentioned at all. In the second pasuk, the simcha now belongs to the father and the mother, and the gila belongs to the Rebbe. So the Gra says, the difference is that pasuk chaf dalet is when the Talmud is learning by the Rebbe, and pasuk chafei is when he comes home to be with his parents. So there, it's exactly the opposite. There's exactly the opposite. At that point, the parents are going to have simcha, all the new chidushim, right, at the Pesach Seder that the son can say. The Rebbe doesn't have the simcha of anything new. He just has the bitachon that the child is on the right derech, right? So it gets reversed in that particular way. But we have to be careful about the Pesach thing. It's an interesting mushroom. You know, I know that when people learn in yeshiva and they come home for the Seder, let's say they're in their parents' home for the Seder, so they have a lot of Torah that they want to share and the like. But you do have to be careful. Sometimes, you know, you might have a very advanced pilpul, etc., and it may not be matim for the audience. I still remember when I was in Ner Yisrael, so I came home with all sorts of things, and I assumed everybody would be very, very interested. So I was going on with the Rambam and it's crazy. I'm looking at it now. It's like so idiotic to do, but I was doing it. Berkshire, my parents were fine. They didn't, you know. But I remember all of a sudden I hear this loud. And we had some guests. This very loud noise, and there was somebody snoring. They fell asleep, whatever it wasn't. Yeah. So you have to be careful that you're mechuyev to kind of adjust whatever Torah you want to say to the people that are there and the like. Okay. But anyway, this is an important gra, the chiluk between gila and Simcha. Now, he makes another chiluk. What is the chiluk between Sasain and Simcha? Sasain and Simcha. Now that's a different chiluk. The chiluk there he makes is, again, Simcha is something new, but Simcha is when you're about to begin a joyous experience. Right? So when your child is about to get married, you have Simcha. Sasain is when it's been completed. That's why it says, Smechim b'tseisam v'sasim b'voam. When the sun rises every day, there is a Simcha as it's doing its mission, and there is Sasain when it completes the mission. But that's still consistent, because that's still going, that Simcha is something new, albeit the beginning of the mission and the like. Now, what do they tell? They tell a famous story about this. There was a maskil who was not even that religious, but he had a great, great desire to meet the Gra, because he wanted to ask the Gra a lot of kashas on psukim and diktuk and the like. So he dressed up like an Italian rabbi, and he had letters. He forged letters from rabbis in Italy to go to the Gra. And he figured he would, that way, you know, that way he would gain admission. And so he went to the Gabbai, whatever the protocol was to get an appointment to see the Gra. But the Gra somehow had a hergish. The Gra didn't allow him to come into his room. The Gra actually stayed at the doorway to talk to him. He said, you can ask me your questions here. So the person had 150 questions. So listen to this. So he asks one question, waiting for an answer. The Gra says, keep on going, keep on going. So the person read 150 questions. So the Gra says, question 1 and question 85, I'm making up the numbers, are really based on the same mistake, and we would answer it this way. Question 2 and question 123 and 137 is based on this mistake. So the person was like out of his mind at the millions here. Anyway, the Gra then said, I want to ask you a question. He says, Chazal say there are 10 Lashainas of Simcha. Gila, Ditsa, all the Lashainas of Simcha, he says. Tell me the difference between them. So the person was actually very, very good in these things. So he went through 9 Lashainas, and he said how they're all different. So the Gra said, okay, but you didn't tell me Ditsa. What is Ditsa? So the person said, well, the Balei Diktuk say that Ditsa does not mean joy. Ditsa is just a term for dancing. So it's not really a Lashon of Simcha. So the Gra said, but Chazal say it's a Lashon of Simcha. You're saying it's not a Lashon of Simcha? I know, but the Balei Diktuk say that Chazal were not accurate here. Wrong thing to say. So the Gra turns around, goes back into his room, and he just closes the door. The meeting is over. Alright, the meeting is over, but the person got what he wanted. So anyway, he's back in his lodging, and there's a knock on the door, and there's some big guys who are the representative of the Kehila of Vilna, and says, are you the person who is just at the Gra's? He says, yeah. He says, well, we have to be ma'anish you. The Gra said, you are malig al dibri chachamim. You made fun of the words of the chachamim. And there actually was a communal sanction. They used to have a stockade, a stock, and they would put the person on there and people would throw things. There actually was in Vilna. This was the procedure in Vilna. That if a person was mavaza talmud chacham or mavaza chazal, there was a communal onesh that was given. So they take the guy and they put the guy in the stockade and they throw stuff at him for an hour. And then he described, I'm not sure if it's totally true, he described being tarred and feathered and being carried out of town, and then like dumped out of town. So he writes a letter about all of these bizyonos. He writes about this. And he says, but you know, it was worth it. he says, I would do it. He says, I would do it again. Maybe I wouldn't say what I said again. But it was kedai to meet the genius of the Gra, even to do it once. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Okay. Okay, then maybe we'll stop here. Okay, all right, have a good weekend.
The Balabai, he's hosting that.
Thank you. The what?
I don't know if it was a true story, but if he was going to ask the Rebbe by charging $100, is that a problem?
Theoretically, it's a problem. On the other hand, it's interesting that, you know, normally Dinei Bastas is when somebody thinks the matzav is better.
Right.
That they think something... The only question is, but you could argue this. You can argue maybe even if it's not Dinei Bastas, you're causing somebody tsar. In other words, the person thinks he has to pay. When he doesn't, there's a certain agmas nefesh that you're causing. So would you look at that as an agmas nefesh? Yeah, it could be. I don't know.
Okay. Thank you, Robert.
Yes, thank you.
I grew up in a school where they used to hit kids. And I was wondering, because I heard different opinions about it. I used to find that the school was very disciplined. Kids are very disciplined. I found that other schools are always very opposite of it. Never used to be that.
Yeah.
Like kids used to be mollycoddled, whatever the case was. But what's your view on it? It's probably not the best thing based on what you said.
I've heard it said that Gedolim have said that Bizman Hazeh, we should not hit children. We need to discipline children.
Yeah.
And there need to be rules. But hitting just causes resentment and hate. We're a weaker generation, and the child will perceive hitting as very.
It's never ever perceived as a positive.
The Gra says, you know, gentle hitting, you know, is okay, but it should be more symbolic. You know, it shouldn't be causing pain.
Yeah.
Discipline is not to cause physical pain.
Yeah.
It's to make a child realize what is right and what is wrong. I just want to tell you one final mitzvah with this. You know, the best discipline I ever heard, Rav Shimon Schwab of Washington Heights, used to say that the way his father and mother would discipline the children is that they used to have bread and jam every morning. So if they misbehaved, the kids would not get jam on their bread, but the parents wouldn't eat it either. The day that the child didn't have, the parents didn't have. And the kids felt so bad, their parents didn't have, that they said, I'm not going to do this again. You know, that was the idea, that I'm not here to punish you. I'm here just for you to understand that this was a bad thing that you did. Says. Okay, good one.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Something that said something in the back of this parish on mission that something about evolution, and this Rebbe said
about what?
That a certain parish on mission has said that it's a good parish, but definitely you should use it. But he says something in the back about evolution.
Oh yeah, it's very special, yeah.
So this Rebbe said you should rip that page out. And one of
you talk about a Rebbe, a present Rebbe?
Modern day.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't want to be chaylik on someone's psak, but I would say, by and large, if someone that is makubal as a gadol b'torah said something, I don't see why you would rip it out. Maybe you could teach that we're not makabel that day, we don't paskin like that day, that's fine, but I wouldn't rip it out. This is the works of a gadol b'torah.
He was coming against evolution, that people shouldn't get misled to it.
Okay, so maybe that's a Harash Shah. Okay, I could maybe hear in the Yeshiva based Medrash where anybody could get it, but I mean, I certainly wouldn't tell every person you have to rip it out.
Okay, and not to read it.
Yeah, again, it's hard for me to say. If a Gadol B'Torah said something, why can't I read it? I mean. Gadol B'Torah said it. I can't characterize it as kvira. But again, No. As a matter of fact, it isn't. You know, Rav Shimshon Fall Hirsch wrote when this was right after Darwin came out with the theory of evolution. He said like this. He says that, you know, evolution is a theory. It hasn't been proven, etc. But he said the following. Im Timsel Lomar, that Darwin could prove, it's impossible, but if he could prove evolution 100%, it would not change anything, because as long as you believe the Ribbono Shel Olam orchestrated the process, So he did it this way. In other words, the only thing that would be direct kfira is if you factor out a Kadosh Baruch Hu from the process.
That's what they're doing. The whole thing of evolution.
That's not what Tzur Yisrael was doing. Of course, Tzur Yisrael didn't say Hashem didn't make the world. Right. No, you're right. I understand. So I could tell you don't read Darwin. I understand. There is a whole branch of evolution believers who are called creationists. There is such a mahalach that Hashem orchestrated the processes of evolution. Now, you could say that's wrong, you could say it's incorrect, you could say it contradicts the pashtus of the psukim, that's all true. But it wouldn't be apikorsis, it wouldn't be kfira, because it is, and when the Tzurish Yisrael is saying that, he's obviously working with that. He certainly was not a kifer in HaKadosh Baruch Hu creating the world. Chas v'shalom. So if he's finding a way to reconcile, Rav Hirsch said the same thing. Rav Hirsch said you could find a way. There was a gadol, a very, very, very chashuv person. He's not so well known. I think I've mentioned him before. Rav Gedalia Nagel, who is Rav Chaim Kineski's chavrusa. He's a really, really chashuv person. But he was not a Rosh Hashiva. He was a businessman, whatever. He was called Chad Bedara to become such a gadol and not in the full-time Torah world. And they published a book, I have to go back, I believe he even talks about evolution, but he certainly talks about age of the earth and dinosaurs. And he says, all of these things are yitachin. And it couldn't be, you can't dismiss him. He was really very, very great. So,
was the name of him or the Sefer?
The Sefer is Mitoraso Shel Rav Gedalia. Mitoraso Shel Rav Gedalia. Huh? Nadal is his last name, Nun Dalet Lamed is his last name. Very, very chashuv. He was close to the Chazon Ish. He was a Talmud of the Chazon Ish, actually. Yeah, so he and Rav Chaim grew up together, basically. Yeah. Chad Bitar, very, very unusual person.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be
overly. No. I have to respect what this Rav said too. I can understand, but I think Bederach Klal, if Gedolei Torah, especially, see, it's interesting, especially if an Acharon says it. In a way, you might say the censorship of not censorship, but maybe not reading some Rishayim might be more justifiable because the Acharonim have come to a Hachra. But if it's something Acharonim themselves are debating, so I don't think you could say there's such a halacha psuka in those things.
Someone said that, a person that wants to bookmark a sefer, Shofan sefer, by folding a paper like that, to me it seems very wrong, but I don't know if it's us or...
No, I think it's put down to be zion to the sefer. You don't...
Baker did not.
I'm not sure if it's absolutely us, but I think the post can bring down that it's not covered for a sefer to do it that way.
Thank you.
Okay. Have a good week.
Thank you very much. Is the shiur going to be here or
I'm not sure. I think okay. So we'll be back. Although I actually like this room, but I guess maybe it's crowded. There's more people. Okay. All right. Let's go. Have a good week. No. That's someone's going to pick that up.
In my
Sefer, Hila is
Gila and Simcha. The other one, Hila is Simcha, is Tamid, and Gila is.
Really?
Is,
wow. It's very interesting. The Malbim is often Mechavin to the grass. It's interesting when they say the opposite. Mm-hmm. Okay, take care. Yep.
onto it. Now, again, before I continue here, I do want to implore everybody, if you haven't heard the podcast yet, please go listen to the entire thing. I want everybody to get the full context and to get the full perspective. And then if you agree with him, fine, you agree with him. If you disagree with him, that's also fine. But get the full experience before you decide to take sides on this. So anyway, here's his direct quote that's causing some controversy on the internet, and then I'll break it down for you. Sam says, given a choice between Noam Chomsky and Ben Carson, in terms of the totality of their understanding of what's happening now in the world, I'd vote for Ben Carson every time. Ben Carson is a dangerously deluded religious imbecile. Ben Carson does not... The fact that he is a candidate for president is a scandal, but at the very least, he can be counted on to sort of get this one right. He understands that jihadists are the enemy. Okay. Now, again, go listen to the whole thing. He comes with just a waterfall of hedges and caveats because he is a smart guy, unlike many people think and say. I've always disagreed with anybody who's ever called him a bigot or whatever, a xenophobe or an Islamophobe. I think all of those attacks are totally unfair against Sam. I've defended him in the past on those points, and I will continue to defend him on those points. But in this particular case, do I think this is a fair criticism of Noam Chomsky from Sam Harris? No, I do not. So, his position is, as I understand it, he's saying, look, on virtually every other issue, it's obvious that Noam Chomsky is better than Ben Carson, and Ben Carson believes things that are ridiculous, and Sam Harris could give you a laundry list of a million areas where he disagrees with Ben Carson. But he's saying on this very, very specific issue, this one issue of Islamism and jihadism, he doesn't think Noam Chomsky gets it, and he misses it so much, in Sam Harris's opinion, that would justify a vote for Ben Carson over somebody like Noam Chomsky. So, first of all, do I think that Noam Chomsky doesn't get it on jihadism and Islamism? No, I do not. Now, I know Sam vehemently disagrees with me on this point, but the core of it is this, and this is what I've been trying to stress in this entire debate from the beginning. Guys, it's just a matter of where you put your focus when you have the conversation about jihadism and Islamism. So, Sam would focus on, and he's not wrong to focus on this, in fact, he's right when he focuses on the ideological religious aspect of it, where people truly believe in paradise and they have internalized this belief system, and their concerns are not secular, rational, terrestrial grievances. And he makes that point, he hammers it home, and he makes it very well, and he's not wrong on that. He's not wrong on that, okay? But he thinks that Noam doesn't get it on that point, and I don't think that's true. I think Noam gets that, but almost as a matter of principle, Noam decides to talk about other factors that are part of the same problem. The problem of the popularity and the increasing strength of Islamism and jihadism around the world. And what Noam focuses on is, what are we responsible for in this field? That's not to say we're to blame 100% for everything. He wouldn't make that claim, and if people believe that, that's a caricature of what Noam actually believes. But he focuses almost as a matter of principle on how we've made it worse. So, for example, he could point to us funding the Mujahideen in the 1980s under Reagan, because we were so against the Soviet Union that we would fund anybody who would fight them, and of course they were fighting the Soviet Union at the time. There was a war in Afghanistan. So we backed people who later became the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. We gave them funding, we gave them weapons, and a guy like Noam Chomsky would say, hey, you jackasses, never do that ever again. Now, obviously, Sam would say that as well, but Noam would focus more on that because he thinks that you have to get your own house in order first, and there's an easy way to stop terrorism. It's stop participating in it. So we shouldn't kill civilians, and also we shouldn't fund people that do the worst things around the world. So another thing Noam would focus on is that we prop up and fund and give a tremendous amount of money and take the oil from the Wahhabi regime in Saudi Arabia. Another thing he may focus on is that, hey, you know, we're backing Islamist rebels in Syria against Assad, who's a secular Ba'athist leader. Why would we do that if we have a commitment to, you know, the proper values system and we really are the world police? Why would we prop up some of the worst, most backwards Islamist jihadist regimes? So you're talking about the same problem, Islamism and jihadism, but you're talking about different aspects of it. Sam is focusing on the ideological issue itself and how liberals need to acknowledge that that exists. And Chomsky is focusing on the things that we've done, not to create the ideology, because he wouldn't say we created the ideology, the things we've done to fund that ideology.
And we are extremely happy to have Professor Noam Chomsky with us. Let me just say that he is the most quoted writer in academia alive. No comparison at all with anybody else. And I think it's fair to say he is number one public intellectual in the world. So please, Professor Chomsky, the floor is yours.
I'll talk some about Isaac Newton and his contributions to a study of mind, that he's not known for that, but I think a case can be made that he did make substantial, indirect, but nevertheless substantial contributions. I'd like to explain why. There is a familiar view that the early scientific revolution, beginning through the 17th century, provided humans with limitless explanatory power, and that that conclusion is established more firmly by Darwin's discoveries theory of evolution. I have in mind specifically a recent publication, exposition of this view by two distinguished physicists and philosophers, David Albert and David Deutsch. But it's commonly held with...
Good evening, I'm Bill Moyers. What's more dangerous, the big stick or the big lie? Governments have used both against their own people. Tonight I'll be talking with a man who has been thinking about how we can see the developing lie. He says that propaganda is to democracy what violence is to a dictatorship. But he hasn't lost faith in the power of common people to speak up for the church.
Tuesday, Alan Dershowitz and Noam Chomsky debated how to end the Israeli-Palestinian conflict at Harvard University's Institute of Politics. This is an hour and a half.
Born in Brooklyn, Professor Alan Dershowitz graduated from Brooklyn College and Yale Law School. At Yale, he graduated first in his class and served as editor-in-chief of the Yale Law Review. After clerking for Chief Judge David Breslin and Justice Arthur Goldberg, he was appointed to the Harvard Law faculty at age 25. There wasn't even time for you to join a mid-career program here at the school. And he became a full professor at 28, the youngest in the school's history. When not teaching students, he found time to be one of the country's most accomplished defense lawyers and authored over 20 books. His latest, The Case for Peace, How the Arab-Israeli Conflict Can Be Solved, has received favorable reviews from former President Bill Clinton and Middle East negotiator Dennis Ross. At Harvard Law School, where he is the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law, Professor Dershowitz teaches courses in criminal law, constitutional litigation, civil liberties and violence, legal ethics, and human rights. Professor Noam Chomsky. Son of a Hebrew scholar, Professor Chomsky was born in Philadelphia. While he acquired his PhD from the University of Pennsylvania in 1955, much of his research leading to his degree was done here at Harvard between 1951 and 1955. In 1955, he joined MIT and in 61 was appointed full professor in the Department of Modern Languages and Linguistics. From his articulate opposition to the Vietnam War in the mid-60s, to his book Manufacturing Consent in 1988, and to his even more challenging text, 9/11, published after the terrorist attack that year, Noam Chomsky has never retreated from taking on the most pressing issues of our day. Professor Chomsky is the Institute Professor of Linguistics at MIT and teaches classes in linguistic theory, syntax, semantics, and the philosophy of language. Before we begin, And to set the appropriate tone and context for this evening, I'd like us to have a brief look at a short clip from a forum event last year.
Hi, my name is Laura Daggy. I am a junior in the college. And I was wondering, as a leader who is internationally recognized in the struggle for peace, what advice do you have for the rising leaders of our generation?
First of all, don't be like us. Be different. You know, personally, I have very little patience for history. I believe that to imagine is more important than to remember.
Let me just repeat that so that we have that as the tone and the context for our discussion tonight. And I quote from Shimon Peres, first of all, don't be like us. Be different. Personally, I have very little patience for history. I believe that to imagine is more important to remember. So tonight, let us imagine what should be the next steps in the process of achieving peace in the Middle East. For your knowledge, a coin toss conducted by the Harvard Speech and Parliamentary Debate Society has determined that Professor Dershowitz will speak first for 10 minutes. After that, we will go directly to Professor Chomsky, and then the floor will be open. Professor Dershowitz.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor for me to be participating in a debate with a man who has been called the world's top public intellectual. My connections to Noam Chomsky go back a long time. In the 1940s, I was a camper and he a counselor in a Hebrew-speaking Zionist camp in the Pocono Mountains called Camp Masad. In the 1960s, we both worked against the Vietnam War. In the 1970s, we had the first of our many debates about the Arab-Israeli conflict. I advocated ending the Israeli occupation in exchange for peace and recognition of Israel. He advocated a one-state solution modeled on Lebanon and Yugoslavia. We debated again in the 1980s and the 1990s. I have the text. I hope that our once a decade encounter will continue for many decades to come, though I doubt we will agree with each other. The debate today occurs at a time of real potential for peace. Shimon Peres, Israel's elder statesman in the peace camp, today quit the Labor Party and announced his support for Ariel Sharon in the upcoming election. Quote, in my eyes, it's not a problem of parties, but a problem of peace. How to create a strong coalition for peace. The elements are now in place for a real peace. As I wrote in the case for peace, when the Palestinian leadership wants a Palestinian state more than it wants to see the destruction of Israel, then we find in peace a two-state solution. The untimely death of Yasser Arafat makes the two-state solution a real possibility. I call Arafat's death untimely because if it had occurred 5 years earlier, we might now be celebrating the anniversary of Palestinian statehood. Arafat's decision to turn down the Clinton-Barak plan for Palestinian statehood was characterized by Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia as, quote, a crime against the Palestinians, in fact, against the entire region. The crime and the death that it needlessly caused can never be undone. But this is a time to move forward and to assure that the crime is not repeated. The time has come for compromise. My friend Amos Oz, the great novelist and leader of the Israeli peace movement, has said there are two possible resolutions to a conflict of this kind, the Shakespearean and the Chekhovian. In a Shakespeare drama, every right is wronged, every act is revenged, every injustice is made right, and perfect justice is prevails, but at the end of the play, everybody lies dead on the stage. In a Chekhov play, everybody's disillusioned, embittered, heartbroken, and disappointed, but they remain alive. We need a Chekhovian resolution for the Arab-Israeli tragedy. This will require the elevation of pragmatism over ideology. It will require that both sides give up rights. Giving up rights is a hard thing to do. It will require that each side recognizes and acknowledges the pain and the suffering of the other. And it will require an end to the hateful attitudes and speech that some on each side direct against the other. Sometimes it's better to start at the end. The ultimate solution is not as much in dispute these days as is the means for getting there. I believe that even Professor Chomsky and I have the same basic agreement about a number of very important elements of what a pragmatic resolution might look like. Professor Chomsky now acknowledges that the two-state solution may be, quote, the best of the rotten ideas around. I'll settle for that. He also seems to acknowledge that those who advocate the so-called Palestinian right of return are pandering to their people and misleading them into believing that there is yet another weapon, a demographic weapon, that can destroy Israel. I think we both agree that Jerusalem should be divided essentially along demographic lines, with the Palestinians controlling the Palestinian population and Israel controlling the Jewish population, that the borders between Israel and the Palestinian state should be based roughly on the UN Resolution 242, that Israel properly ended its occupation of the Gaza, and that it should end its occupation of all Palestinian cities and population centers on the West Bank, that terrorism must stop, and that the Palestinian state that results from this peace must be as contiguous as possible and economically and politically viable. There remain considerable differences between us, and more importantly, between the Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority that must resolve these issues and actually sit down and make peace. Some of these differences are attitudinal. I believe that peace is a realistic possibility, whereas Professor Chomsky apparently believes there is no chance for peace, at least as reflected by the German title of his new book, Keine Chance für Frieden, which translates as no chance for peace, why a Palestinian state is not possible to be established with Israel and the United States. I hope you're wrong. Other differences are quite specific, relating to precise boundaries and considerations that are quite important, the devil always being in the details. I strongly believe, however, that there is a genuine will for peace on both sides now, and that the pragmatic differences can and will be resolved. And here I think the Academy can play a very important and positive role in fostering peace. At the moment, I'm sad to report that many academics around the world are contributing to an atmosphere that makes peace more difficult to achieve. They are encouraging those Palestinians who see the end of Israel as their ultimate goal to persist in their ideological and terrorist campaign. By demonizing and delegitimating Israel in the international community and on university campuses throughout the world, they send a doubly destructive message to those who must make peace on the ground. To the Palestinians, the message is don't compromise. If you hold out long enough, the next generation of leaders will buy into your efforts to delegitimate Israel and will give you the total victory you seek. To the Israelis, the message is whatever you do in the name of compromise, you will continue to be attacked, demonized, divested from, boycotted, and delegitimated. So why make the compromise efforts? As I travel around college campuses in the United States, I notice a stark difference. Many of those who support the Palestinian cause tend to be virulently opposed to Israel, comparing the Jewish state to Nazism and apartheid, comparing Shimon Peres to Hitler and Idi Amin, calling Israel the world's worst human rights violators, and suggesting that Israel should be flattered by a comparison with the Gestapo. These are all quotes, the Amin-Hitler quote from Professor Chomsky, the comparison with Gestapo from Norman Finkelstein. Whereas most of those on the Israeli side tend to be supportive of a peaceful Palestinian state. Put another way, pro-Palestinians tend to be anti-Israel, whereas pro-Israelis are often pro-Palestinian as well. It was not the Israelis who scuttled the United Nations two-state solution in 1948 and themselves originally occupied Gaza and the West Bank with little or no objection from the international community. That was Egypt and Jordan. It was not the Israelis who turned down Resolution 242 in 1967 with the famous three no's, no negotiation, no peace, and no recognition. As Abba Ibn put it, this is the first time in history that the side who won the war sued for peace and the side that lost the war demanded unconditional surrender. It was not Israel that turned down the generous offer at Camp David and Taba. The Palestinian leadership has never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. But it is not too late for peace now. I wish to end my opening remarks today by making a specific proposal directed to my distinguished opponent. I propose here today a peace treaty among academics who purport to favor peace between Israel and the Palestinians. I believe that by agreeing to this peace treaty and by implementing it, academics can actually contribute to encouraging a pragmatic peace. I call today for those who have supported the Palestinian cause to stop demonizing Israel, to stop delegitimating Israel, to stop defaming Israel, to stop applying a double standard to Israel, to stop divestiture and boycotts of Israel, and most importantly, to stop being more Palestinian than the Palestinians themselves. I call on academics who support Israel not to call for a greater Israel, nor to call for a continuation of the occupation of Palestinian cities, to stop being more Israeli than the Israelis themselves, and to join the vast majority of Israeli and American supporters of Israel who favor the two-state solution. If the two elder statesmen of Israel, Sharon and Peres, can place pragmatism before ideology and peace before party, and come together toward the center in the interest of a pragmatic peace, then surely two elder statesmen of the American academic debate over Israel who share this platform tonight can also make our contribution to the peace process by encouraging those who respect us and sometimes follow our guidance to move closer to the center and closer to accepting a pragmatic, non-ideological resolution of this bitter conflict. Ecclesiastes many years ago said, "To everything there is a season, a time to throw stones, a time to gather stones, a time for war and a time for peace." This is the season of peace. Let us not let it pass us by. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Dershowitz, Professor Chomsky.
Mr. Mandel will confirm. There was an explicit condition for this debate. That is that neither participant tried to evade the issue by deceitful allegations about the other. So I therefore congratulate Mr. Dershowitz on having made a true statement. I was a counselor at Mossad. About the rest, there happens to be an ample record in print, or if you like, you can ask a question, but I'll keep to the topic and the rules. The topic is, where do we go from here? The answer to that is largely up to us. Evidently, it requires some understanding of how we got here. The question of where we're going now has a clear answer. It's given accurately by the leading academic specialist on the occupation, Harvard's Sarah Roy. She writes that under the terms of disengagement, Gazans are virtually sealed within the strip, while West Bankers, their lands dismembered by relentless Israeli settlement, will continue to be penned into fragmented geographic spaces, isolated behind and between walls and barriers. Her judgment is affirmed by Israel's leading specialist on the West Bank, Meron Ben-Denisti, who writes that the separation wall snaking through the West Bank will create three Bantustans, his words, north, central, and south, all virtually separated from East Jerusalem, the center of Palestinian commercial, cultural, and political life. And he adds that this, what he calls the soft transfer from Jerusalem, that is an unavoidable result of the separation wall, might achieve its goal. Quoting still, the goal of disintegration of the Palestinian community after many earlier attempts have failed. The human disaster being planned, he continues, will turn hundreds of thousands of people into a sullen community, hostile and nurturing a desire for revenge. It's another example of the sacrifice of security to expansion that's been going on for a long time. a European Union report concludes that U.S.-backed Israeli program will virtually end the prospect of a Palestinian state by the Canaanization and by breaking the organic links between East Jerusalem and the West Bank. Human Rights Watch, in a recent statement, concurs. There was no effort to conceal the fact that Gaza disengagement was in reality West Bank expansion. The official plan for disengagement stated that Israel will permanently take over major population centers, cities, salient that divides the southern from the central Bantustan, to use Benvenisti's term, and also announced other expansion plans. Now, there is near unanimity that all of this violates international law. The consensus was expressed by U.S. Judge Bergenthal in his separate declaration attached to the World Court judgment ruling that the separation wall is illegal. In Bergenthal's words, the Fourth Geneva Convention.
Comment from briefing from Professor Chomsky.
For those of you who want to see the maps that lie behind Mehran Benvenisti's and Sarah Roy's and Human Rights Watch and the European Union and other comments, I have them here. But there's a very simple test that we could try. That's a valid approach to contiguity for the Palestinian state in 22% of the former Palestine. Let's propose it for the Israeli state in 78% of the former Palestine. Let's ask who would dream of proposing that.
It was proposed. The Peel Commission proposed accepted it.
In 1937. But well, the relevant period.
When
we're talking about today.
When thousands
today, who would propose that for Israel?
When thousands of people have been killed by terrorism, you don't expect a country to go back to a proposal that was offered and rejected many, many years earlier. Options change when rejectionism sets in.
Okay, let's go to our next questioner.
Coming back to 2005, you mentioned the connection between Professor Deshmet. My name is Talal Salman, by the way. You mentioned the connection between Gaza and West Bank,
right.
But I think to follow up on my colleague, I'm not sure if this is what he meant. What about the pieces of West Bank we're going to end up with?
Okay,
settlements are continuing to be built inside the West Bank. The wall is being built inside the borders of 1967. So now, please talk to me about peace, about pro-Palestine, when it comes to building walls and actually separating the West Bank from East Jerusalem.
Okay, here's what a Palestinian state would have looked like had Camp David and Taba been accepted. It would be a completely contiguous West Bank with an area that, including Ma'ale Adumim and some of the other areas right side of Jerusalem, which would become part of Israel and would remain within the wall. The ultimate goal is to have a separation fence that is on the border, the accepted border. And I'll tell you what I think the real options are today. The real options are, if this new peace party wins, if the Sharon Peres peace party wins, it will offer the Palestinians a very good deal, a deal much like that what was rejected at Camp David and Taba. And by the way, if you think it was the Israelis who rejected it, just ask Bill Clinton. He has told me, Dennis Ross has told me, it was completely in the hands of the Arafat, and that's true of Prince Bandar as well. But if it gets accepted this time, and if the peace party prevails again, they will be offered something very, very close to that. It will be a viable Palestinian state, much more viable than anything Israel was offered and accepted in 38 and in 47. And I think every reasonable person today would urge the Palestinians not to repeat the disastrous mistakes they made in 48, they made in 67, they made in 2000, they made in 2001. This time, say yes, accept a Palestinian state, build it, create an economy, create a political system, and finally peace can be achieved.
Thank you, Professor Chomsky.
For those who you would like to see the map, I have it. It's, as I said, from Ron Pundak, the leading Israeli scholar, the head of the Shimon Peres Peace Center. It shows, this is the Camp David map, which Clinton recognized was impossible, which is why they went on to Taba. And it cuts through the West Bank completely. It's not that. It is.
That's the one the Palestinians. We know, sorry, everyone can see them clearly.
Ron is not a Palestinian. He's the head of the Shimon Peres Peace Center.
This is Dennis Ross's map.
Yes, Dennis Ross was the U.S. negotiator.
That's
whose
right.
word is meaningless. Ron Pundak is a leading Israeli scholar. And if you want to go into why Ross's book is worthless, I'll be happy to say it. It's obvious to any reader. It stops.
You know,
right
it's obvious to you, it's not obvious to other people.
Well, I'll tell you why. It stops, notice that his book stops immediately before Taba. Why? Because Clinton's parameters and what Clinton said about the acceptance of him by both sides and the Taba negotiations completely undermines Dennis Ross's book. So he therefore terminates it right before that and can therefore make these absurd claims. But if you want to learn something about it, look at Israeli scholars. It's much more serious.
Thank you.
Good evening. I'd like to thank both professors for speaking so eloquently tonight. My name is Josh Suskowitz. I'm a recent alum of Harvard College, and I'm really glad to be back. I have sort of a simple question for Professor Chomsky. It seems to me that you left out in your analysis the elements of violence, psychological, physical, against Israel, against Jews. And it seems to me also that the history that Professor Dershowitz described, a lot of that is dictated by what happened, the terrorism, the wars against Jews, especially considering the immediate history right before the establishment of the State of Israel, the Holocaust, and everything that has happened since. So I'd like you to address the effect of the psychological effect and the physical effect of war and terrorism on Israel.
Well, that's half of a very important question. The other half of it is, what's the effect of war and terrorism on the Palestinians? Now, if you take a look at, we're not supposed to talk about that question here, but if you look at them both, you'll find that what Penny Morris described is in fact correct. The balance of terror and violence is overwhelmingly against the Palestinians, not surprisingly, given the balance of forces. And that's even true, that's true right to the present. I mean, for decades, Israel was able to run the West Bank virtually with no forces, as Morris pointed out, others point out, because the population was so passive. While they were being humiliated, beaten, tortured, land stolen, and so on, just as I quoted, finally there was a reaction. And it's interesting to see the U.S. reaction to it. In the first month of the Intifada, this one, October 2000, in the first month of the Intifada, 74 Palestinians were killed, 4 Israelis were killed, it's all in the occupied territories. The Israeli army, according to its own records, fired 1 million bullets in the first day, which disgusted the generals when they learned about it. Israel, first few days of the Intifada, was using U.S. helicopters, they don't make them, U.S. helicopters to attack civilian complexes, apartment houses and so on, killing and wounding dozens of people. And the U.S. did respond to that. Clinton responded by sending the biggest shipment of military helicopters in a decade to Israel. The press responded, too, by not publishing it. I should add, refusing to publish it because it was repeatedly brought to their attention. Well, while the ratio was 20 to 1, which is pretty much what it's been for a long time, there was no concern here.
Creating educated citizens.
Between the American media, that it's the United States that has rejected the two-state solution, when every
judgment went on to practically destroy the country, the number of people killed in that terrorist attack, translating to per capita equivalents here, it would be about 2.25 million. That's more than the total in all U.S. wars ever. There were no targeted assassinations. And unlike Israel, Nicaragua didn't even close newspapers. I mean, Israel has repeatedly closed newspapers, even in Israel, but mostly in the occupied territories, because it claims that they have some connection with terrorists. The leading newspaper in Nicaragua, right to the end, was owned by a supporter of the U.S. terrorist army and was openly on its front pages calling for the overthrow of the government. Occasionally they reduced some of its newsprint. They never closed it. That's one case, an obvious one. Take an even more obvious case, Cuba. The United States launched, since we're at the Kennedy Center, I can point out that John F. Kennedy launched a major terrorist attack against Cuba in 1961, right after the failure of the Bay of Pigs. It was a very serious terrorist war, plenty of documentation about it from the best sources you like, Arthur Schlesinger, Raymond Gartoff, all of you can read that. Major terrorist wars going on right to the present, based in Florida. Cuba has not carried out terrorist actions in the United States.
So Cuba has a better human rights record than Israel.
No,
Chomsky.
On the issue,
but nowhere else in the world.
Sorry, on the issue of preemption, which is the one you raised. Yes, you raised the challenge about preemption. And I told you that there are many much better cases.
No, I didn't say that. Let me be very clear what I say
right now. Israel and the United States are both threatening Iran with destruction. Preemption, according to Dershowitz, would require that Iran be carrying out targeted assassinations in Israel and the United States.
We're going to go. This is going to be our last question.
My name is Laura Christopher. I'm a second year MBC student. Thank you for this lively debate. I have a question kind of directed at both of you. But Professor Dershowitz, in your book you said you hope to have a win-win situation where everyone had to give something up. And what's clear to me after this debate and just looking at history, that no one's able to come to a resolution where they're willing to give up enough to the other person. So it seems to me that the only way to win is to have everybody lose. So I'd like you to comment on a proposal where maybe if you all lost, we'd actually come out winning.
Well, I think there is a win-win possible situation. Israel has been giving up much. It gave up the Gaza. It, by the way, offered to give up the Gaza to Egypt way back in the early 1980s, Egypt wouldn't take it back. There was no international outcry over the occupation of the Gaza by Egypt for 20 years, nor was there any international and I'm sure there must be a long record. Check Chomsky's writing. He must have in print large opposition to the occupation of Gaza by Egypt and strong opposition to the occupation of the West Bank by Jordan. Funny, I never came across it in my research, but I'm sure it must be there if you check at least the Czechoslovakian version of one of his writings. So I do think there's a win-win solution. The win-win solution is the one I proposed starting in 1967, and that is Israel make territorial adjustments necessary to secure its boundary and securities consistent with Palestinian rights, no occupation of Palestinian cities, a two-state solution. That is a win-win situation. And let me tell you why I consider myself pro-Palestinian. I am pro-Israel and pro-Palestinian because I favor a viable, healthy, economically strong, politically democratic Palestinian state. That will be good for Palestine, it will be good for Israel, it will be good for the world. Israel has a major stake in the success of Palestine, whereas the Palestinians have never had a major stake in the success of Israel. And so I see a successful Palestinian state, a viable, largely contiguous Palestinian state, as a win-win situation, not only for Israel and the Palestinians, but for the United States and the rest of the world. I only hope that Professor Chomsky can join me in agreeing that we're not going to get a perfect solution. And let's just advocate a solution that's acceptable. The question that was asked before was to me the key question. If the Palestinians accept the solution that Professor Chomsky finds unacceptable, will he use his enormous resources as the most influential intellectual in the world today to turn the Palestinians against this peace proposal, or will he lend his great prestige to urging the Palestinians and his academic supporters all over the world to accept a pragmatic compromise solution. Professor Chomsky, a lot turns on you. You are a very important and influential person, and therefore you ought to understand your power and use it in the interests of peace.
Okay. Just before I ask one of the most influential intellectuals today to respond to Laurie's question, just to tell you where we're headed, Professor Chomsky will respond. Then, in accordance with our rules of procedure and decorum for this evening, I will ask Professor Chomsky to offer a two-minute summary for the evening, to be followed by Professor Dershowitz. Professor Chomsky.
Yes. Well, with regard to my opposition to the Jordanian-Egyptian occupation, there is ample material in print, and there has been for 35 years, ever since I publicly and openly and very prominently supported the two-state settlement, which Mr. Dershowitz says he now supports. I'm glad to hear that. I don't have the background evidence. Let's return, and that means, of course, opposing Jordanian-Egyptian occupation. Let's turn to the question we were asked to address. Where do we go from here? Well, we actually have two fundamental choices. One choice is to support Washington's continued dedication to the road to catastrophe that's outlined by Israel's four former security chiefs, namely watching in silence as Washington funds the cantonization of the West Bank, the breaking of its organic links to Jerusalem, and the disintegration of the remnants of Palestinian society. That choice adopts the advice of Moshe Dayan to his cabinet colleagues in the early 70s. Dayan was in charge of the occupation. He advised them that we must tell the Palestinians that we have no solution. You shall continue to live like dogs, and whoever wishes may leave. That's the solution that is now being implemented. Don't take my word for it. Go check the sources I cited. Very easy, all English. There's an alternative. The alternative is to return to the spirit of the one break in U.S.-Israeli rejectionism. That is, the week in Taba in January 2001, before Israel called it off, and to take seriously the follow-up proposals from high-level negotiators on both sides, of which the Geneva Accords are the most detailed. There is overwhelming international support for taking them as the basis for a political settlement. It does come close to the long-standing international consensus that the United States and Israel have barred, and that I've personally been supporting for the last over 30 years. That's the road away from catastrophe, towards an end to violence, and towards eventual reconciliation. Either choice is within our reach. From that point on, it's up to us.
Professor Dershowitz.
We do seem to have a remarkable point of agreement. I think we both do agree that the proposals made at Taba do provide a useful basis for a peace process. Now, Taba didn't end because Israel left. Taba ended because Arafat rejected Camp David, thereby causing the election of Sharon over Barak. There was no government, essentially, that could carry out the Taba proposals, which were favored by a very, very large number of Israelis. That's why Prince Bandar said to Arafat at Camp David and at Taba, if you reject the proposals at Camp David, you're going to get Sharon instead of Barak. You're never, ever going to get a better deal. Thankfully, he was wrong. Sharon emerged as a man of courage and a man of vision. And I myself, although I never did support Sharon in the past, strongly support the efforts made by Sharon and Peres, a great, great man of peace, a man who has vision, a man who imagines the future, a man who can bring about peace in the world and peace in the Middle East. And I think the prospects for a peace based on the Taba proposal are quite realistic. I think that if this party wins the election, and invites the Palestinians to the table, and the Palestinians don't again miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity, there will be a real prospect for negotiation, a real prospect for a peace based on pragmatism. One final word.
Associate editor of Saturday Night Magazine.
You say that what the media do is to ignore certain kinds of atrocities that are committed by us and our friends, and to play up enormously atrocities that are committed by them and our enemies. And you posit, in fact, you say in the Massey lectures that there's a test of integrity and moral honesty, which is to have a kind of equality of treatment of corpses.
Equality of principles.
That every dead person should be in principle equal to what every other dead person.
That's not what I say at all.
Well, I'm glad that's not what you say, because that's not what you do.
Of course it's not what I do. Nor would I say it. In fact, I say the opposite. What I say is that we should be responsible for our own actions primarily. That's something quite different. I wasn't equating them. I was comparing the treatment of them. If you want my value judgment, we should give much more attention to one priest who we've killed than to 100 priests that they've killed. Notice that this is exactly the human thing.
Associate editor of Saturday Night Magazine.
He presented some of the material in these lectures to an audience at Ryerson Polytechnical Institute in Toronto, after which he was questioned by a panel of Canadian journalists. This is David Frum, associate editor of Saturday Night Magazine.
Professor Chomsky, you argue for a model of the media in which the media argue for and defend the established institutions of society, and any deviation from that defense is dismissed or even suppressed, so that views that are dissent from the overwhelming consensus that characterizes our society cannot get a hearing. Now, here you are tonight in a large lecture hall, Canada's most prestigious journalism school, speaking to an audience of journalists who are hearing your remarks with apparent approbation. Your remarks are being broadcast on the government-owned radio network as part of the most prestigious lecture series on that network. How'd that happen?
Recall that what I said was that this is a very good first approximation to the description of a complex social institution. You remember that I mentioned, I'm afraid this remark may sound a little insulting, but let me try to say it without sounding that way. I specifically mentioned that in the United States, for example, if I wasn't talking about, say, listener-supported radio in a small community. In fact, as you get away from the elite centers that matter, things open up. Okay. Now, the fact of the matter is that Canada is a much more open society in this respect than the United States, and the reason is it's less important. This generalizes. I can talk this way in Belgium, you know, in Israel, in Latin America. I can't talk I can talk this way in the United States, but not on national radio and television, because it's just too important. What people think about international affairs in Canada just doesn't matter that much to established power. If it did matter that much, Canada would close up too.
If CBC then is just a small a publicly funded station in some small town, looked upon to that perspective, why don't we turn to the CBC person on stage here, and Margaret Daly, perhaps you can have a turn.
Well, I was intrigued by the thesis and particularly impressed by the volume of sort of factual documentation that I look forward to reading this stuff in a long version. I guess the question that I want to ask, though, is, given that this information is so, given that this information isn't discussed, you lay it all out, supposing people knew it, and obviously individuals do know it, minorities, individuals, foreign affairs buffs, if you want to call them that, those kinds of people can assemble all this information. Then what? It doesn't seem to make any difference, and why is that?
It does make a difference. I think it makes a lot of difference. I mentioned, not entirely jocularly, that if a third world country today were to put forth the American Constitution, we'd call it a reversion to Nazism. And I mentioned that that's a sign of hope and progress. There has been moral progress over 200 years. There's also been progress over 20 years, 30 years, I mean, my active lifetime. Again, I'm talking mostly about the United States, but it's a different country than it was 20 or 30 years ago. Now, elites are not different. They're pretty much as indoctrinated as they always were. Elite group, contrary to a lot of necessary illusion, elite groups, including liberal intellectual elites, did not oppose the Vietnam War. They supported the Vietnam War, supported it enthusiastically. They began to turn against it somewhat after Wall Street turned against it, and more or less for the same reasons, because it was too costly. The media were almost totally closed to critics of the war. But among the general population, this crisis of democracy did take place, and it changed the society. I think it led to a permanent cultural change outside the elite centers. And the United States is just a different country than it was 20 years ago in a lot of respects. Everything from interpersonal relations to treatment of ethnic minorities to concern over international affairs and so on. You can see, and the reason is because while the major institutions of indoctrination continue on their natural course, other modes of interaction did develop. And they remained, you know, they're informal, they're inefficient. I've probably 80%, I don't know.
A New York City postal worker has been charged with a hate crime after he was caught on surveillance harassing two Muslim women. Now, not only did he harass them, he threatened them, chased them into a store, and even spit on them. The man's name is Dayton Foley, and according to reports, Foley, who was wearing a U.S. Postal Service uniform, began cursing at the women and making anti-Muslim comments. Now, keep in mind that one of the women is pushing a stroller or had a baby with her. We have the video surveillance for you, so let's take a look at that. Okay, so there he is. He's yelling at both the women. At one point, a woman told him, "You're crazy," and he said, "I can't be crazy. I work for the post office."
That was the worst argument ever made. "I can't be crazy. I work for the post office."
Yeah.
As he's going postal office.
He apparently called them a Bumkalot Muslim.
He's Jamaican.
He's Jamaican, yes.
Yes.
And he also said, "I'm going to burn your Muslim temple down."
Yeah. As soon as he said Bumkalot, I was like, oh, God.
What does that mean?
Dakota Point to
have to cut. What do you mean?
Draft a release about the alternative energy summit Josh is holding this afternoon.
Hey, that's not gonna work.
Which I don't recall asking.
No meetings in the counteract.
I should give Dan Concana access for a feature.
Yes.
You're wrong.
Okay.
You should. Why?
He's cute.
I'm leaving.
Do you have my two-page summary?
I'm sorry?
Do you have my two-page summary?
Yes.
Could I have it?
Yes.
Thank you. reversed my decision.
Yeah.
I gave this to you to summarize, and you didn't summarize it so much as you reversed my position.
I gave it a little polish, yeah.
You reversed my position.
It's shorter.
It is shorter, and you reversed my position.
Your position was wrong.
Can you step inside, please?
Sure. Half of America's workforce is employed by small business. That's companies that employ fewer than 100 workers.
I know what a small business is.
Then you know that a third of them fail. One third of all small businesses lose money and fail. Not because of rent hikes or big chains squeezing them out, but because of why?
Employee fraud.
That's right.
Yes.
What do you say to that?
You reversed my position.
Other than that, Sam, other than what you've been saying for the last hour and a half.
I can't believe I'm listening to a Republican tell me the government should run background checks and impede business. In fact, I can't believe I'm listening to a Republican. Could it possibly be that most of the people you want to fingerprint have darker skin than you do?
Well, not to let the facts interfere with a good story, but 80% of violators are white. Fraudulent employees are 3 times more likely to be married. They're 4 times more likely to be men, 16 times more likely to be managers and executives, and guess what, Professor? They're 5 times more likely to have postgraduate degrees.
You listen. All right. Start from the beginning.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you eating that donut?
Take the donut. Start from the beginning. Yeah. The Commerce Department wants us to back an amendment to a bill that would help small businesses with fraud prevention and employee theft. We want to recommend it.
You have numbers?
Yeah. This is from an independent study that I have faith in. 30% of workers plan to steal from their employers. 30% give in to occasional temptation. 5% will commit fraud regardless of circumstance. 85% will commit fraud given the right circumstances.
Just out of curiosity, what are the right circumstances?
Need, opportunity, and the ability to rationalize their behavior. It's called the fraud triangle. You know, it's going to help us out when we want to raise the minimum wage. Small business owners who are most opposed to wage hikes.
You weren't going to go the other way on this?
Yeah, I was.
You got turned around?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Thanks.
Hang on, I wanted to...
Thank you, Leo.
That was it?
Yeah.
That was it?
Yeah.
I don't understand.
You don't understand why?
What just happened?
Leo said yes, we're in.
I don't understand.
Leo said yes, that's the end of the meeting.
I was just talking, Sam. I was just talking to you.
Well, we play with live ammo around here. You convinced me, I convinced Leo, Leo convinced the president.
Sam.
It's a short day, Ainsley, in a big country. We've got to move fast.
And so because I said this in here, the president in there is going to... You got to tell me when that's going to happen. Is this how you guys decide to go to war?
I don't know, I'm usually not in the room when they do that.
Sam.
Could somebody give her a cupcake or something?
Sam!
Hi, honey, how are you doing? Yeah, so it really is interesting. Right. Yeah. Okay, I'll be home soon. Yeah. Okay, we'll see you soon. Bye-bye. Okay. All right. Okay, you can mention it. Okay, Annie. Bye-bye. See you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, bye-bye.
This morning, or this afternoon, we are privileged to have a record here with us. He has asked that I not introduce him personally. That's why I speak these words to you. Reb David is a Rebbe to many, to all of us who honor him for his learning. He's known certainly to all of us, not only as a Rosh Yeshiva, but as the Chazar and the Nasir of the Agudat Rabbanim. As the Chazal said about David, he was the Rawan Shal Yisrael, and viele von dem Zustand, wenn es ist noch leider, dass ich ja Covid verabschiede.
Panic. Engagement.